All right, I'm going to...
Yes, okay, so, sorry.
I'm going to call to order the meeting of November 15th, 2016's Water Commission. If we could call the roll. Roll call. Sorry, Doug.
Excuse me. Good morning. Commissioner Baker.
Here.
Commissioner Ball.
Present.
Chairman Byrne.
Here.
Commissioner Curtin.
Here.
Commissioner Del Bosque.
Here.
Commissioner Herrera.
Here.
Commissioner Orth.
Here.
And Commissioner Quintero.
Here.
Great. We have everybody present. We move to item number 3 on the agenda, which is approval of the October 18th meeting minutes. Moved and...
Seconded
by Commissioner Herrera. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Thank you. Executive officer's report. I should report that Taryn is our interim executive officer as Rachel is out on leave. So yeah, I know you've been in the role before. So
yes, good morning, Commissioners.
Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm actually going to postpone an executive officer's report. Most of the items to come from the executive officer would be part of the Water Storage Investment Program agenda item.
Great. Okay, then moving on to item number 5 on the agenda, which is commissioner member reports. Commissioner Herrera.
I had two separate meetings with representatives of the Temperance Flat Project, one on October 27 and one on November 9th.
Commissioner Orth.
I'll report on meetings on October 19th with representatives of the Semitropic Project, Sacramento Regional Sanitation, and Aqua, each individual meetings. And then on November 2nd, representatives of the San Joaquin Valley Water Infrastructure Authority.
Anybody else? Commissioner Baker?
Last Monday, I had telephone discussion with representatives of the Semitropic Water Storage District, and then the following day I had a meeting with representatives of the Sierra Club and Defenders of Wildlife.
Anybody else? I had meetings with, or phone meetings with the City of San Diego as well as the Environmental Defense Fund, and that's it. Okay, moving on to the next item on the agenda, which is public testimony. This is opportunity for the public to comment on any items that are not on the agenda. If there's anyone who would like to comment on an item that is not on the agenda, please come forward. Seeing and hearing no one, we'll move on to item number 7, which is I see Casey, which is a very quick legislative update. Welcome back, Casey.
It's working now. Good morning. I have for you the standard format legislative update that you've seen in the past. This one reflects the final actions of this last legislative session. What these are, I basically took all the bills that made it to the fiscal committee of the second house and then moving forward. So broke it out into a couple different categories, departmental operations, water conservation, water supply, groundwater legislation, climate change, greenhouse gases, miscellaneous category, and then a few bills at the end that failed passage that we were watching. Again, this is not a comprehensive list of everything that might touch on either water, but it's a good representative sample of the legislation. You'll see our departmental operations legislation relates everything from state employees and disciplinary actions to the Open and Transparent Water Data Act, which everyone was, I think, quite aware of as that was moving through this last year. I'm going to move through these a little bit, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those at the end, but just to give you some idea of what we're looking at. SB 831 here at the bottom of the second slide here, related to funding of the Interlake Tunnel in Monterey County, Monterey County Interlake Tunnel for the it was a water storage, drought preparation, flood kind of combined project that the county is working on. Again, I have the budget trailer bills listed in here. Couple of pieces of legislation relating to geologists, geophysicists, land surveyors. If anyone has anything as we're moving through this, please feel free to jump in, but I'm just going to kind of give you a broad overview of what I'm looking at here. Multi-unit water meters. This is an effort that had been previously worked on and made its way through this year, requiring sub-meters on essentially new apartment dwellings. That's SB 7, Wolk, at the bottom of the page. SB 814 by Senator Hill required local agencies to come up with a structure for excessive water use and defines the amount of what qualifies as excessive water use, and it applies during certain declared drought conditions. Obviously, there were several pieces of legislation relating to the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, some adding specific water agencies as the groundwater sustainability agencies. Some was a technical cleanup. We'll see the climate change and greenhouse gas legislation. SB 1386 Wolk sets up a structure, has Fish and Wildlife setting up a structure for regional conservation planning, attempting to speed along local project work. I have listed here a miscellaneous AB 1716 McCarty, created a Lower American River Conservancy program within Resources Agency, not an actual conservancy itself, but a program. Largely for the purposes of being able to access state funding and other funding for some of the American River projects. And then just to move in here to the end, there's a couple that failed passage. AB 2909, water transfers or exchanges. It was seeking to come up with expedited processes for DWR and the Water Board to approve water transfers. SB 995 Pavley would have required the department to update certain well standards statewide, and that failed passage in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. So this is just kind of the general what were the final disposition of these pieces of legislation at the end of the year. I don't want to take up a whole lot of your time because I know you've got a lot of things on your agenda, but I'm here if you have questions about any of these, or even if questions come up after the fact, I'd be happy to provide information.
Thank you, Casey. And is there anything that, I take it that there's not anything that's directly, and you would have informed us, impacting us and what our primary responsibilities are?
Correct. Correct. There was. I'm working my way back through here to see if I 25 AB 2551, third item on this bill by Assemblymember Gallagher, just grants design build authority to projects associated with surface storage relating to your funding program from Prop 1. But it doesn't have an impact on your work. It doesn't have a requirement upon you. It's after the fact. It grants the project specific authority.
Okay, that's helpful. Any other questions from commissioners? Okay, Casey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to move on to item number 8 on the agenda, which is an update on DWR's tribal engagement. And we've got and Asita Agustinez, which is the WR's Tribal Policy Advisor.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Do you want to call any public comment for
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, if there's any public comment on the legislative item. Seeing none, thank you, Tara. Welcome back, Anastasia.
Thank you. It's always my honor to address your body, Chairman and Commissioners. This is a quick update. I wanted to be able to inform not only the public but the commissioners of a really brief background on my role as a tribal policy advisor for the Department of Water Resources. And as you know, the commission has a special status within Natural Resources Agency and Department of Water Resources. Not having a dedicated tribal liaison, we've begun this relationship with the work that I've been doing at DWR as tribal policy advisor on Prop 1. And so I thought it fit very nicely that I would be able to lend my assistance in the tribal engagement process of what we were doing at the department, not only with SGMA and Prop 1, but also with the work that we were doing with your work on, with the Water Storage Investment Program. Regarding tribal consultation, and that's really where I just want to just dive deeply into consultation. And as you're somewhat, many of you should be aware of, the governor's executive order B-1011, that put into statute or executive order regarding the requirements of agencies for consultation. And that's regarding meaningful input into the development of regulations and policies. And from 2011, our agency, Natural Resources Agencies, developed a formal tribal consultation policy. That is the umbrella policy that your commission and bodies work under, and also the Department of Water Resources. And the it's spelled out quite nicely in the in their consultation policy for outreach as a requirement. When you're doing planning and processes dealing with tribal governments, it set out tribal liaisons to be formed within each department under Natural Resources Agencies. We have tribal liaisons in Department of Parks, myself in Department of Water Resources, Department of Energy, and we all work together under agency and meet quite regularly on a quarterly basis, and we share information under agency. There's also training involved through our departments. I do think that it could be a little bit more robust, not only for new and succession planning, but also on the outreach to the departments and commissions and groups. So I do consider something like this not only training for commissioners, but also to the public in terms of what are the roles and responsibilities of a liaison, or in my case, a policy advisor. These are some of the duties that I'm tasked with under my duty statement at Department of Policy, Department of Water Resources. So I'm a direct report to our Chief Deputy Director and Director at DWR. My job is to facilitate and conduct the government-to-government consultation between DWR and our tribal governments. I also assist in our environmental justice, our flood planning, energy issues, contracts. Climate change has become a big issue, and all of these as they relate to tribal governments in the mandate and the implementation that we're required to under the Department of Water Resources. There's also a need to monitor specific legislation that will affect our department and how it relates to tribal governments. And obviously, 2014 was a watershed year in terms of Prop 1 and SGMA, which was the first time that we've seen from the tribal perspective that tribal governments were included in a very major water bond that allowed tribes to be a participant in that legislation, not only in Prop 1 directly, but obviously, as you know, in your Chapter 8 responsibilities of how then do we include tribal governments. These are the types of tribal engagement we do at the Department of Water Resources. Some of the work that I've been involved with, and since I've been here, I've just celebrated my third year anniversary, and it's been a very deep dive in terms of the water world and what we're doing with various things at the department. So what we've seen is that because we're dealing with water issues, specifically here in the Delta issues, a lot of the times that I'm working with tribes, is going to be sometimes the same types of tribes, same tribes within a certain boundary. So when I'm working on a Delta issue or Central Valley flood protection planning item, then I'm working on the California water fix. So it made a lot of sense then that I would be able to then, with the tribal advisory groups that I've been developing, also then to utilize those same resources rather than recreate the wheels for various organizations or tribal government groups to meet separately with the Water Commission. So it was a matter of being efficient about time and also being cognizant that tribal governments are being required also to work with state agencies. And when you say consultation, it is major, especially with new legislation, in addition to Prop 1 and the water bond, but AB 52 legislation in 2014. And I just put in there that disadvantaged communities and environmental justice community engagement is becoming very much a big part of my time. And the past couple years has been drought emergency management and working with the Governor's Drought Task Force in what we do for tribal governments. And, of course, the Prop 1 water bond and the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. In terms of what we've done for the Water Storage Investment Program is I've been in advisory capacity to the Water Commission. We've developed a tribal representation committee on your stakeholder advisory group. We've outlined a tribal engagement strategy since the beginning of your program. Your commissioners participated in June of 2015 at a two-day tribal consultation on Prop 1 that was created. It was a multi-agency consultation, not only with the Department of Water Resources, but we had our sister agencies, Cal EPA, Drug and Ag, at that consultation. And it was actually the first inclusive opportunity for tribes to have a good understanding what is Prop 1 going forward and what to look forward. And it was very early out the gate. We created a 30-page brochure that I still use, and I've just been meeting with our internal financial assistance branch at DWR. We intend to update that brochure because I get requested by many tribes to send them the copies or the links. And so I work with Tracy Billington, and we are going to be updating the links so that the communities out there can see where are these programs and the various propositions, funding departments under Prop 1, where are they in terms of regulations? Are they ready for solicitation so that the tribal governments and the EJ community can take a look at that and keep track of that? What we've done in addition to the advisory committee is we've developed two public outreach and tribal outreach for tribal governments. On February 24th was a tribal roundtable at Jackson Rancheria. That was an opportunity to work with tribes who had a potential project. They wanted to know whether this was a viable project or not. On October 10th, we had a webinar for tribal governments, and that was to follow up what we discussed in February 24th on early regulation language and to look at the regulation language and to also solicit input. These are the individuals that sat on your stakeholder advisory committee. We had three gentlemen that represented not only their tribal roles for their particular tribes, but they also represented a regional body. We wanted to have an opportunity to have individuals that could also outreach not only to their tribal communities, but the various organizations they sat at. So Chairman Garth Sundberg was also chairman of Trinidad Rancheria, but also chairman of the Northern California Tribal Chairmen's Association. That's a body of 20-plus tribes in Northern California. So he would go to your monthly meetings and then also obviously report back to his tribal governments. Same thing with Vice Chair Arthur Engel. He sat in for Glenda Nelson at Enterprise Rancheria. That's the Central California Tribal Chairpersons Association. That organization represents over 54 tribal governments in Central California. Bo Mazzetti, Chairman of Rincon Band, also the representative from Southern California Tribal Chairmen's Association. That organization has 20-plus tribes in Southern California. So the outreach was strong, and from the stakeholder meetings, individual tribes would get then an additional update from their tribal representative, from their perspective, and there was opportunities when The Northern California Tribal Chairs asked me to do a one-on-one, and there are several government-to-government additional informational meetings that came about once these individuals reported back to their tribal government communities. This is just a quick sheet to have a look at of who and how deep was the outreach during the past year. The commissioners who participated in a tribal roundtable with Maria Herrera and David Orth, that was really well received. There was really great comments, and I do appreciate the time and energy because their conversations more robust than I expected. Tribes were very interested, and I listed here the tribal governments who actually participated in both the tribal roundtable and the webinar. That's over 18 tribes who participated. Not listed on here are federal partners. We had representatives from BIA, US EPA, the Indian Health Service, and other federal organizations, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife at these meetings, because they were also, well, obviously Bureau of Indian Affairs participating as a trustee status for tribal governments, but the other federal partners who then were looking at water planning programs with tribal governments that might be able to assist tribes if they were to go forward with a viable project under your program. These final comments here, or these are some of the issues raised, not only at the tribal roundtable and the webinar, but also in one-on-one meetings and at other meetings where Prop 1 was discussed. Each time I do outreach under DWR, under Prop 1, I always mentioned this water storage investment program. And so obviously some of the major issues has always and will be for tribes, tribal sovereignty issues. We have to pay very close attention to government-to-government relationships. What does tribal sovereignty mean to tribes? When we discuss public outreach meetings and we put out information that says these are public comments, that for tribes are not members of the public. They are a tribal sovereign, and the outline and engagement through tribal consultation will satisfy tribes' ability to say, yes, you are reaching out to us on a government-to-government basis outside of requesting a public comment from a tribal government. Limited waiver of sovereign immunity was discussed in depth in February and in the recent October. I do know that there was language and request by the tribes through formal comment as well as one-on-one, and I think that we've satisfied that the requests based on their discussions with your attorney, and the tribal governments were pleased with that result. Quantification of public benefits, evaluation and scoring process, that's ongoing, and that's something tribes will be paying close attention to, as well as existing JPAs in development, not only in Central Valley, but in other areas. Tribes right now are very involved in SGMA, and they're looking and working with their various local government, groundwater sustainable agencies, and trying to determine how are these government structures mandated for tribes to work with a GSA, and when you have a Groundwater Sustainable Management Act that precludes a tribe from being a GSA. And so tribes are really much involved in looking closely at that. And so I do know that through the other engagement we've been doing at DWR with groundwater has assisted tribes in looking and understanding a little bit more about your program, because it's when you look at, they're familiar with then now with Prop 1 in general, and then looking a deeper dive into Prop 8, Chapter 8. Sacred site protection will always obviously be a strong concern, and I think that that'll be ongoing no matter whether a tribe is a tribal project or not. So as you go forward and we go into regulations and we actually look at project solicitation, and we look at that, tribes who may have said, well, we're not interested in a particular project, you're going to be having tribal engagement from any project you do dealing with cultural site protection, ancestral homeland, even though that may not be a tribal project. So those are issues that tribes will be looking at very closely as we go forward. But I want to thank you for this time and opportunity, and if you have any questions.
Thank you very much, Anicita. That was a great presentation. I want to commend you on the level of outreach over the last number of years that you've been involved, and I think we really appreciate it. And I know that some changes have been made to accommodate concerns that were raised, and it's a credit to what you've been doing that we have so many folks that have been aware of what we're doing and had opportunities to participate. So,
pleasure. Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Okay, moving, I will provide opportunity for public comment. Anyone would like to provide public comment? Seeing none, I'd move on to another informational briefing item, which is number 9 on the agenda, which is DWR's update on water loss regulations. And Todd Thompson, who's a senior engineer, is here to present to us. Welcome, Todd.
Hi there. Thank you for having me. I appreciate your time on this issue. My name is Todd Thompson. I'm with the Division of Statewide Integrated Water Management. My background is engineering. I'm a licensed civil and agricultural engineer. In October of 2015, the legislature and the governor passed, added a section to the water code that requires urban retail water suppliers to submit annual water loss audits to the department. And so we've been working on regulations as stipulated in the statute that will come before you in the near future, probably the first quarter of next year. And so we figure we take this time opportunity to brief you on what we're doing. And so it doesn't come as something new out of the blue for you guys. I know probably some of you have already are well aware of it. So, but I do appreciate your time. First of all, a little primer on water loss, water losses. Municipal systems leak. There's miles of mains and laterals, hundreds of connections and appurtenant devices, and all providing water under pressure. So just like in the household, except on a much, much larger scale, these systems all lose water as it's purveyed out to the public. In terms of, well, what kind of losses are we talking about? We've got some idea just recently with some data that we received from the urban water management plans, which required audits to be provided on water loss. And in terms of water loss, in terms of connections per day, we're looking at somewhere between 33 gallons per connection per day to 348 gallons per connection per day. In terms of water loss per capita per year, we're looking at anywhere from 2,450 gallons per capita to as high as 52,000 gallons per capita. So it can be pretty significant. In total, from the data, what we are looking at, and we called the 50 municipalities with strong audits that were showing fairly large losses, we're looking at between 50 million gallons a day to over 5.5 billion gallons a day. But now keep in mind that's a striking number, but that's probably a very, very large system. And the larger the system, the more water is going to be lost in the system. So, yes.
I'm sorry. So, they said 33 to 340 per day. Was that on what kind of?
33, and that was per connection per day.
Per connection. Thank you. Sorry.
Uh-huh. Sure. My pleasure. The key to addressing water loss in the system is by doing water loss audits. So you're paying attention to what's going out and what's being billed, and you do that through auditing and looking at the data and the data scores. The value of the data that's going into the audits is also important. That's just a primer on water loss. Oops, backwards. DWR isn't a stranger to water loss auditing. Back in '88, we had our guidebook number 5 in association with the Cal Nevada section of the American Water Works Association. And that basically established a standard, the start of a standard nationwide. That has blossomed into what is the nationwide standard, which is the document on the right-hand side of the screen, and that's the 2016 Water Audits and Loss Control Programs document. And that is produced by the American Water Works Association and supported by them. And that's a nationwide standard. Basically, in terms of audits, audits are basically an accounting of the water that's being provided into the distribution system through the point of customer consumption. And the difference between the two is basically what is established as a loss. And those losses can be real losses in terms of water leaking from the system itself, or what we call apparent losses, which are basically unbilled water that's being used as from fire flows, or maybe meter errors, just in terms of metering inaccuracies. Validation is something that's a little bit newer. Validation is looking at the data that's going into the audits. Back in 2010, the state of Georgia, after their historic drought, established a water loss auditing program for their urban water retail suppliers. And what they found is that the first several sets of data, first audits that came in weren't very good and didn't provide as much useful information for the utility or for the state as was intended. And validation is a way to fix the correction. It's kind of like a garbage in, garbage out. You try to keep the input data very, very good so you have a very strong audit from which to work from. Our utilities are performing audits at this time, most notably those members of the California Urban Water Conservation Council. Under Best Management Practice 1.2, they've been doing audits on their systems since 2010, so 200-plus water systems in California have 5-plus years of data, and so this is not something completely new for the state. In addition, as I kind of briefly mentioned, the urban water management plans were required to have a water loss audit attached to their water management plans. And so every one of our urban retail water suppliers have performed a water loss audit to date. So this is something that won't be new, completely new for them. The future will be annual audits, though, for the urban retail water suppliers. So that is going forward. And so what will we be looking at in the regulations? Basically, the regulations were pretty straightforward because what was in the statute was pretty prescriptive. There wasn't really a lot of wiggle room. And so what we're looking at is specifying the reporting requirement of October 1st, 2017, and annually thereafter for urban water audits, validated urban water audits. The regulations are going to require that they use the national standard, the AWWA standard. All the audits are going to be required to be validated so that the audits and the data coming in is going to be good and useful for the utility and also for the state. The persons performing validation, there'll be prescriptive requirements for minimum standards of validation and what they have to do, interviewing staff, looking at the data sets and stuff like that. In terms of the certificate for validation, there'll be a requirement for that too, and that was required in the code. Luckily, we have our partners with the California Nevada section of the American Water Works Association stepping up to establish a certificate program to keep the level of professionalism high, and we do appreciate that they've taken that step forward. Um, There's also going to be reporting requirements, who signs the documents, including the validator and the person responsible for the utility, general manager, et cetera. What the utility is doing to improve their audit score and what they're doing to minimize their water losses in the previous year. So, we weren't the only agency to have requirements on us in the statute. The water boards also had requirements on them in the statute. They are required to provide technical assistance to the water utilities and to establish performance standards for water loss audits after 2 full years of data. So they have something to work with to establish water loss audits, performance standards for those audits. To date, we've established a draft regulation. It's currently in internal review. We've put it through three stakeholder meetings, so we've got some good input from the industry. Our stakeholders were comprised of private and public agencies, some of them that have very good water loss audit programs. Some of them have growing water loss audit programs. We also had an environmental representation with the NRDC. They are very interested in this program and supportive of it. And trade industry associations like AQUA and the California-Nevada American Water Works Association. So we've had some really good input to help us craft the regulations. State Water Resources Control Board has secured a contract grant for the Cal-Nevada American Water Works Association. And they are actively engaged in with that contract. The California-Nevada American Water Works Association is actively engaged in training utilities on water audits, and they will be providing the first level of validation for the 2017 submittals, which will be a big help. It's a good step forward. Last slide. Roughly, this is our best take on our timeline. We're hoping to get a submittal to the Office of Administrative Law this month. It is in review, and if not this month, it'll be early next month, I think. With that, that'll kick after the publication date. That'll kick off our 45-day public comment period, which will culminate in a public hearing. And then depending on the level of comments and the amount of changes that we do with our regulations, we're looking at coming before you in the first quarter of the coming year. So with that, I'll take any questions that you guys have, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Todd. Commissioner Curtin.
So I'm assuming that this is the first step in leading to proposals to deal with the loss of water, the measurement capabilities, the analysis, the auditing, to not just identify, but, all right, let's figure out where these water losses are either capturable or, you know, I think maybe there's, and tell me if I'm wrong, maybe there's some cases where the losses may be in the system but actually are not necessarily detrimental to an integrated system. And my thought is groundwater capture just by simple loss of moving water. But that is, I'm assuming, the intent of this program?
Auditing is the first good step on identifying water losses. And, not all losses are worth fixing.
Right.
So anyway, this is the first good step forward towards identifying water losses for the utilities to decide how they want to deal with losses in their program, for sure.
Questions, comments? Okay, thank you very much, Don. Appreciate taking the time. Look forward to seeing you in the first quarter next year. Okay, moving on to item number 10 on the agenda, which is the update on the Groundwater Sustainability Act. And I'm sorry, before I do that, are there any public comments that were on the previous? Yeah, I'm going to be perceived to be stifling public comment. Anybody? Nobody. Okay, great. Move on now to item number 10, which is Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. We've got Trevor Joseph back for an update. Welcome, Trevor.
Thank you very much. So again, my name is Trevor Joseph. I'm the Assistant Program Manager for the Sustainable Groundwater Management Program. And today I want to give an informational update on our best management practice project. This is actually one of the last of the kind of legislative mandated activities that the department's had to do the last couple of years. So we're really kind of at a turning point with this program, and I'll explain that in more detail kind of on the last slide. I do have about 20 slides. I'll try to move through them kind of quickly as I give an update. So the significance really today, though, is that we have five what we're calling best management practice documents draft on our website, and we're looking for public comments throughout this month. And these documents are really valuable, we hope, to stakeholders, practitioners, those involved in SGMA, to help with the implementation of the Act, as well as specifically approaching and developing groundwater sustainability plans. So just a little background, I won't go through all of this. You're familiar with a lot of these required items in the Act. And as I mentioned, we're completing a lot of them, a couple of them still left to do this year. So just to highlight a few, as you know, you've approved two emergency regulations, the basin boundary emergency regulations. We've gone through a round of basin boundary changes. We provided updates earlier this year. We also had the tremendous lift, the big one really, the groundwater sustainability plan emergency regulations that was approved by the commission on May 18th. Those items in the box are still left to be done. Water available for replenishment. This is a report out that's due at the end of the year that some colleagues are working on, not my group in particular. The best management practices, that's the reason we're here today, give you an informational update on that item. Also due, essentially, I guess, the end of the year, first of next year. We have a Bulletin 118 interim update that really just is going to be a pretty brief document that really memorializes the changes to basin boundaries and a few other technical items. We're looking to complete that also by the end of the year. Huge lift for local agencies. The bottom right is forming those groundwater sustainability agencies. We have a role in posting those notifications. That will continue until June 30th of next year. And then beginning next year, we may get a few alternatives to groundwater sustainability plans and start the review process, really implementing that GSP regulation, because we'll have an obligation to review these alternative plans, if you will, to groundwater sustainability plans. So by no means are we kind of getting to a point where we're going to be done with a lot of activities. A whole second phase of work really begins. And again, I'll get into that in a few minutes. So again, today's focusing on BMPs. I'd like to point out that the Act really doesn't provide a lot of prescription on what best management practices are or need to be. And that's great. We actually like that flexibility because we're trying to do a lot of different things kind of within that project, if you will. Specifically, here's what the Act says. It's in the Technical Assistance Chapter, Chapter 7, and it just says that we need to publish BMPs by January 1st, 2017. We need to have these four public meetings. Today is one of those public meetings. We were in Willows yesterday, and we have a couple more public meetings later this week, and I'll give an update on that as well. So how we're looking at this project, again, is with some flexibility. We think BMPs are really technical assistance to provide clarification or provide examples to aid local agencies, stakeholders, GSAs in the development of GSPs and SGMA implementation. It's important to note, though, that BMPs are not requirements. BMPs are guidance. The regulations are the requirements. So the BMPs are optional for local agencies, stakeholders to use. Encouraged, perhaps, but they are optional for those entities to use. However, with two caveats, and that's kind of on the bottom left here, is the GSP regulations. If you remember, there were a couple of sections that require that local agencies either develop their own BMPs for some technical items or adopt the department's BMPs. Those have to deal with monitoring protocols and installation of monitoring sites. So two of the draft BMPs that we have out right now are out to achieve that purpose. A local agency can use ours or develop their own as it relates to those specific technical activities. One other item I kind of want to point out real quick is the bottom right. We think this is an ongoing project. Even though we have a legislative obligation to complete it by the end of the year, and we will, we feel that this is ongoing. And what we mean by that is there are perhaps subjects that we didn't discuss in the detail necessary to aid local agencies in these draft documents. We feel that we can certainly amend the documents in the future, add subjects to the BMPs in order to provide ongoing assistance. And the importance for us is, you know, instead of going to public meetings trying to wave our arms around explaining how we can all provide assistance to complete groundwater sustainability plans, we're hoping these are our technical manuals. We can sit down with local agencies, talk through some of the specifics, both in the regulations and the best management practices. So we think that there are important items to kind of continuously work on to aid with SGMA development and GSP development. Just really quick, we do think that the BMPs certainly are the technical assistance, and there's some other guidance documents we're putting out, and I'll explain that in a few minutes. But there's no reason to really rewrite existing standards. There's a lot of good reference work that's been done the last couple of years. There's case studies out there on sustainable management and groundwater management. At some point, we hope to have our website be the hub for this information, but we're not looking to recreate a lot of good information that's out there. We focused initially with these first draft documents specifically on technical assistance, creating best management practices of our own, not trying to recreate something that is value added that's already there. I'll go through these really quick, but our process to get where we're at is we didn't have as much time to work on this project as the regulations. Those of you that remember, we had a lot of advisory group meetings on the regulations. I think we had north of 66 advisory group meetings, a very important project. Obviously, this is important as well, but there just wasn't as much time to have that many advisory group meetings. We did have a few advisory group meetings, but we had the surrogate of the survey that we put out to gain input on what topics, what interests folks in terms of development of best management practices. Don't expect you to really read this, but these were the different categories that were in the survey. This really didn't surprise us. A lot of the technical items that we prepared in the best management practices, including water budget, monitoring, they were of the highest ranked topics by local agencies and survey respondents, as well as some of the most challenging aspects of SGMA, frankly, in a groundwater sustainability plan, that is how to approach that undesirable result, measurable objectives, minimum thresholds, these new terms, either in the Act and the regulations, that ranked really high with survey respondents, how to approach these items. And I'll explain what we hope to do there to provide some assistance on that in a minute. And then finally, the survey, we got a decent distribution of respondents. I'm glad we got a good distribution. I'm also glad that we got a lot of local agencies and stakeholders, practitioners that are going to be out there working on GSPs. So we did think that the survey was a success, as well as we had a series of text boxes in the survey where folks could provide some specific narrative and instruction. We did look at that information before developing our best management practices. So let me transition then to the BMPs. I just have one slide really on each document, just kind of summarizing it. But I also wanted to focus on a four-page framework document that we have on our website. And this document is intended to not only provide how to utilize this information, kind of the limitations of the BMPs. Again, it's not a new requirement for local agencies. They're optional guidance information. But also to explain how these BMPs fit together in perhaps a progression in terms of looking at how to approach GSP development. What I mean by that is this diagram here. This is one way to look at developing a groundwater sustainability plan. Again, you have to look at the regulations ultimately, but if you were to try to kind of summarize the major components that need to be addressed, They're kind of these building blocks, if you will. Outreach, incredibly important. That is clearly in the Act and in the regulations. A lot of outreach requirements. Basin setting, extremely important. They're all important. Planning, projects and management actions, and monitoring. And so what this diagram shows in that framework document is the five best management practices that we've released here initially as draft are those bullets there. So we have two monitoring BMPs, as I mentioned, a modeling, hydrogeologic conceptual model, and water budget. At the same time, we're also putting out guidance documents. And this is a little different. It's not the technical assistance components specifically in the regulations, but important information that we also feel is incredibly necessary to get out there as soon as possible. We released two kind of more simple guidance documents with these BMPs a few weeks ago as draft. One is a checklist, and one is a outline, a GSP annotated outline. Checklist, as it sounds, is pretty simple. It's just all the regulatory requirements, the SGMA requirements, so as folks are preparing their plan, they can go to that, see if they've kind of covered everything. And then the outline, also pretty simple. It's optional. You can use this outline. We get a lot of questions. Is this the outline DWR prefers? No, not necessarily. You don't have to structure your GSP that way. But if you don't have an outline and you're at that point and need some guidance there, that document's available to you. If you have a good groundwater management plan that you just need to add some of those regulatory requirements to, you're free to use your own structure. So those are the items that we're working on now. And it, as you can see, we have that asterisk there, kind of small, but in development, there are a couple items that we still need a little more time to work on. I'll explain them here on this subsequent slide. Just other graphics in that framework document to try to explain the interrelationship between what we released and what we're about to release. So the timing of these documents, as I mentioned, we have the draft BMPs out there. We released them October 28th. We have those guidance documents that we also released on October 28th. We're working right now on a guidance document called Engagement with Tribal Governments, working with Anacita. This is a document that essentially summarizes a lot of the engagement that has occurred with facilitators in tribal governments, as well as our advisory group with tribal governments. They have a suggested approach in terms of how they're engaged, and we want to be able to provide that summary to local agencies so they're aware of how tribes wish to be engaged in the process of developing a GSP. So we're interested in getting that one out and done by the end of the year. And then the other two, more of a general stakeholder engagement and communication guidance document we're working on. And then the other one there, establishing sustainable management criteria. What this is getting at those items that were identified in the survey or highly ranked. How to address undesirable results, how to look at and establish minimum thresholds, how to establish measurable objectives. Again, these new terms in SGMA, complex. We recognize that was the hardest part of the regulation to write, is that framework on how to develop those quantifications in your groundwater sustainability plan. What the regulations didn't allow us to do is to use graphics and to use kind of a stepwise process or a flowchart or examples in terms of how to approach those specific requirements. And so that's what we intend to do with that guidance document, is to explain that regulatory section with those aids, if you will, of graphics and flowcharts and that kind of thing. So hopefully that will be a useful document in the near future. So a couple of slides then just summarizing the best management practices. But before I get there, this is the structure. This is just a screen capture of the monitoring protocols BMP. And what this shows is just the outline. Essentially, the outline's the same in each of these draft best management practice documents. I won't go through it all, but a lot of the first four sections are relatively the same, some background, use, objective, that kind of those kind of items. But item five, or chapter five, I should say, the technical assistance, that's 80% of these documents. That's the real meat. That's the guidance, the how to approach, in large part, these regulatory requirements. We've also structured these BMPs, so hopefully that you can see that they track with the regulatory requirements. And what I mean by that is, for example, the regulations have a water budget section that requires specific things, line by line. The guidance, or excuse me, the best management practices have that same order. So hopefully you can see water budget requirement A, and then you can hopefully see the corresponding how to approach that in a best management practice in that document. Doesn't mean you have to do it that way. There may be other ways to achieve that regulatory requirement, but there are that guidance, that how to in those best management practice documents. All right, so the five BMPs, just real quickly, the monitoring protocol standards and sites. This document specifically is really, again, kind of the how to collect data so that it's done in a consistent manner. And that's really important because the timing, the way the data is collected needs to be looked at basin-wide and sometimes basin-to-basin. And so there needs to be standard procedures, processes, as it relates to a series of items, including establishing those sites, and then those specific items related to measuring, monitoring, sampling, that are really get to those sustainability indicators that are identified in the regulations and those undesirable results, avoidance of those undesirable results. So this document, again, is really at driving at how to do those specific technical data collection activities to drive consistency basin-wide. Monitoring networks and identification of data gaps. This one's a little different. This one's more about the spatial distribution and temporal frequency, if you will, of how data is collected. Very important, but you can't be necessarily prescriptive either, that perhaps a certain distance between monitoring wells is appropriate in one basin, but another basin has different conditions, different size. It's a completely different spatial distribution would be appropriate. A different spatial distribution would be appropriate. So this provides some guidance on how to approach that requirement of avoiding or minimizing data gaps and coming up with the right spatial distribution and correct frequency of monitoring and data collection. This document also gets at some guidance on these representative monitoring points that are identified in the regulations. I know this is getting a little technical, but this is very important from a compliance perspective because undesirable results are going to ultimately be measured in terms of how conditions are monitored and measured at these representative monitoring points. So this diagram here shows a basin that's perhaps has four different management areas, and these little targets or these are the representative monitoring points, and then which sustainability indicator is monitored at those points. And so there's some guidance on how to set up representative monitoring sites, again, a regulatory requirement in this best management practice document. Hydrogeologic conceptual model, best management practice 3. A little hard to read this graphic there on the right, but hydrologic conceptual model is incredibly important. It's really the basis for establishing and understanding your basin setting. Again, a regulatory requirement. And why it's important, it's kind of shown there in the middle, is a lot of additional technical items branch from that hydrogeologic conceptual understanding. How do you set up then a numerical or a model is based on a good hydrogeologic conceptual understanding. How you identify those undesirable results, how you set up monitoring, water budget information, and then also communicating with stakeholders in terms of outreach. These graphical representations and a good hydrogeologic conceptual description is imperative. And so again, regulatory requirements, there's a series of then guidance in this BMP on how to meet those specific requirements. Water budget. One slide really doesn't do water budget justice. It's a very important component of the regulations. What I kind of want to highlight here is that each of the BMPs we have kind of a what we're calling a fundamental section that goes over a 101 understanding, if you will, of the importance of that topic. In the water budget BMP, it's a little longer. Explains some of the fundamentals related to water budgets. You have your inflows and your outflows, and then the difference is a change in your basin storage. And so it gets into some of those fundamentals, and then it gets into the specific regulatory requirements, again, how to account for those inflows and outflows, change in storage, and then define sustainable yield. So it provides that that explanation. This also gets into how to approach the water budget from a tabular graphical format requirements, provides some examples, and then gets into how to define current historical and projected water budgets, again, those regulatory requirements. Finally, modeling. This document gets to the types of models. Again, provides that overview, some of the fundamentals, kind of the modeling 101, so folks can understand the importance of monitoring and the regulatory significance, the different softwares, models used for the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, and I'll touch on that in a second. That technical assistance provides some guiding principles for models. Specifically, this gets to the proprietary issue that came up during the regulations. There was concerns about local agencies continuing to use proprietary models. This provides some guiding principles in terms of if you are going to continue to use a proprietary model. And there's reasons for doing that. Again, we didn't want folks to have to spend millions of dollars to develop a new model if they've already invested in a model that's working. But this gets at some guiding principles in terms of continued use of that proprietary model. You cannot use a proprietary model if you haven't already started a model after January 1st, 2015, and that was a regulatory requirement. And then it gets into the considerations, the uses of models, how this can help address and identify whether the sustainability indicators, at what point they'll turn into undesirable results, so it's that forecasting, how to aid in development of water budgets, and then assessing impacts to adjacent basins, all uses of groundwater models. There's some flow charts and processes in this diagram as well. And then that bottom right is something we're working on that explains where all of the models are in California and where they can be found and how they can be used. So that's an ongoing activity, is to really map out models for use in the future in GSPs. That's not specifically identified in this BMP. And I'll explain that these BMPs, we're starting to gray the distinction between now the regulatory requirements and starting to use these in a process to aid local agencies, and I'll get into that. This is one example where we're starting to branch out beyond the BMP and get into more technical assistance. The aforementioned, I won't go through this, I'll just go through this really quickly. The aforementioned checklist and annotated outline are also up on our website. I mentioned public meetings, so tomorrow we'll be in Clovis and Thursday we'll be in Santa Ana. We're again looking for public comments. We had really good feedback yesterday in Willows. We had about 40 folks, which we actually exceeded what we thought we'd get, so that we had a really good dialogue and got some really good input yesterday. We want to close this public comment period hopefully November 28th. I know that's not a lot of time, but again, we have this regulatory deadline of then working on comments and getting things done before January 1st, 2017. So we're hoping that we receive all of our comments by the essentially close to the end of the month. Here's how you can send us comments. You can also contact me directly, but we're interested in those comments. And then this is my final slide, and this is what I mean by kind of graying now. We're moving beyond a lot of these phase one, as we call them, activities for the department. Local agencies still have a lot of work to do to work on GSA formation and starting to get their governance in place and thinking about developing a groundwater sustainability plan. But from our perspective, we're really interested in now moving to the second phase. That would be this GSP preparation and submission. And we feel that there's at least kind of four different groups of activities that we'll be working on to hopefully aid in the development of these GSPs. Planning assistance, working with our regional coordinators, getting out there even more in a more coordinated way with these GSAs as they're starting to form to be that planning assistance arm. GSP compliance, what we mean by this is we want to have those technical discussions. This is back to the BMP, spreading them out there on the table with local agencies as they're starting to develop the plans. We don't want them to go away and just provide a plan at the deadline and hope that it's going to meet all the requirements. It's best that we get into a dialogue and start to talk about what the compliance and the requirements are looking like and what they're thinking of providing to us. Technical assistance. This is an item that is we're working on to explain how we can provide and provide data sets. There's a lot of activities that's more cost effective perhaps for the state to provide. Maybe there's subsidence INSAR data statewide, our groundwater elevation monitoring programs in the regional offices, coordinating those efforts so that local agencies can take advantage and stakeholders of that information. So we're re-gearing our technical assistance arm. And then financial assistance, that's always ongoing. There's some Prop 1 money still, obviously somewhere around $86 million in that $100 million bucket of Prop 1 money for aiding with the development of these groundwater sustainability plans. There'll be more on that item in the near future, but we have that financial assistance branch and arm that's working to get some funding out there, seed money to get these plans in place. And then at some point, you know, in 2022, then we'll morph a little bit more to a regulatory role. You know, those other phases then we'll have the responsibility of reviewing these plans to see if they're acceptable. But we think that that's still an ongoing process of working with local agencies and stakeholders. We want them to be successful, and so we're gearing up in this format to hopefully so we can get a high rate of success in this effort. I know that was a lot. I appreciate your time, and are there any questions?
Thank you very much, Trevor. It's very thorough. Appreciate it. Any questions or comments from commissioners? Commissioner North.
Trevor, two questions real quick. The comments that you're receiving on the BMPs, are they going to be made available on the website or?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, the written comments will be made available on our website. We'll get them up there. Okay. And we've received, I think, just a handful, and we're working to get them up there now. But I think like three so far, so it hasn't been much.
And then on the monitoring BMP, my recollection is there's quite a bit of monitoring guidance in the CASGEM framework. Help me understand, does this build on that? Does it require a deeper dive? Where do you see the correlation between the CASGEM monitoring and the BMPs for SGMA?
Some of it's going to look repetitory. I mean, some of the requirements in terms of spacing or suggestions on well spacing is straight from CASGEM. So we're building on that. There are some useful information certainly in CASGEM. But monitoring in general in SGMA does take it up a notch, potentially. If your CASGEM level of monitoring isn't going to be enough for sustainable groundwater management, and it may not be enough in some certain areas, there is a requirement to address those data gaps. And so there's definitely more information in this BMP than prior CASGEM documents.
I'm trying to flesh out whether or not the BMPs are going to require a minimum density and resolution or whether or not you're going to leave that still up to the local agency to define.
That's still very much up to the local agencies. And so this guidance document doesn't provide, I mean, there are some suggestions, but it's not incredibly prescriptive.
Okay.
Because we recognize the huge variability.
Any further questions and comments? Commissioner Curtin.
The proprietary modeling, I'm assuming, has to fit within all the data you're looking to collect. It just can't be, this is our model, that's the end of the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the reason for the best management practice there is some guiding principles. A lot of it's also so it's clear to stakeholders, you know, what the expectations are if local agencies are using proprietary models. So that's a transparent process. I'll also say, though, that modeling in itself is not a, it's a tool. It's not specifically a compliance standard. It's those avoidance of undesirable results. So this modeling You know, some would say all models are wrong, some are useful. So, you know, models are always can be improved and used differently to achieve different outcomes. They're incredibly important. It is a requirement in the regulations, unless you can show a different way to achieve some of those requirements of forecasting without a model. But for the vast majority of basins, we're expecting that models are utilized. The purpose, the way we set it up in the regulations, again, though, was at the issue of some have invested millions in models that have been that are proprietary, and they're useful. And we're going to take a look at those results and see if we agree with what they're forecasting, how they're using them in their groundwater sustainability plans. But ultimately, it's outcome-based in terms of avoiding these undesirable results. So if they're not effective and it's not proved out in the empirical data ultimately, they're kind of only hurting themselves if the model is ineffective.
So there is some financial assistance available. You mentioned $86 million. What chapter is that in?
So that's in Proposition 1.
Yeah.
And there was one round about a year ago or so that awarded $6.7 million to counties. But there's, I think, 86 point something remains. And that's actually your system branch. I know enough about that to get in trouble.
Okay, so that could help on adapting model existing modeling or improving modeling, and then technical assistance in terms of...
Yeah, so they're working on specifically what will be the eligible projects and activities for that funding. And when I say projects, I don't mean large-scale infrastructure projects. Their activities related to development of groundwater sustainability plans. Mm. So there's not an official document yet out on specifically what those activities encompass. But the thinking is we want a large portion of that funding to go towards the development of these groundwater sustainability plans. And so they have a public process as well to talk about what are those activities. And then they'll focus in on that and write those instructions through that public process.
So where do you think we are on the five stages of grief here? We're getting past, we're getting close to acceptance, and I guess it's different in different places, huh?
You know,
because this is an amazing program and there's an awful lot of work and complexity in it.
I think
I can see how it could stun some people.
What surprised us with the amount of folks we saw yesterday, I think, is their level of engagement, which we didn't see 2 years ago. Even when we were talking about maybe more significant activities like the start of the regulations, just wasn't quite on everybody's radar yet. And folks are really coming out with some really good questions. So I think and a lot of questions and approaches to how to achieve the outcomes in the regulations. So a lot of positive involvement. So I think it's a good sign. We're making progress. And local agencies are really starting to reach out to us. How can we help? And so as soon as we're done with these legislative mandated requirements here, we want to get out and start this process of getting in the trenches with these folks and trying to get adequate plans.
Do you see any thinking among these groundwater agencies of the storage program potential in their sustainability plans?
Yeah, we're not getting a lot of that input yet. And I think part of that's the projects and actions are kind of at the end of
down
that
the road.
Thinking. Yeah, they're still focused on GSA formation and governance.
Yeah.
Some of them that have more or less got that figured out are now starting to ask us some plan questions, but we're not getting into the projects and actions really yet. They're starting to they're working really on how are we going to define these undesirable results. That's where we're at right now.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
One last commissioner comment, Commissioner Herrera.
So I actually have a comment and a suggestion. Going back to when you talk about the guidance documents, you mentioned that in late 2016, early 2017, you will be working on developing a document around stakeholder engagement and communication. And before that, you talked about one specific for tribal governments. I just want to encourage you to take a specific look at engagement of disadvantaged communities and individuals that are served by private wells. I know that usually when we talk about engagement of those of those stakeholders, we tend to rely on, you know, the county governments as sort of the vehicle to outreach to them. And those of us that work with the disadvantaged communities know that mechanism doesn't always prove to be the most effective one. And I know there's been a lot of investment by the Department of Water Resources around the state to look at how to improve engagement of disadvantaged communities. So hopefully you guys are looking at some of those DAC pilot reports and working with the nonprofits that, you know, work directly with the disadvantaged communities. Related to that item, I think those of us that are working on implementation efforts now through the GSA formations, we've identified a number of areas where it's not just about creating a seat at, you know, within the GSA for the disadvantaged communities, but then also working with the DACs themselves to be able to build their capacity so that they can engage. And then oftentimes those seats are shared between multiple DACs, and then so we're having to develop mechanisms for them to share that seat and coordinate amongst themselves. So those are sort of things that I would hope that these sort of guidance documents highlight and also give recommendations on templates or other tools that can be used. My suggestion regarding the financial assistance that you mentioned, the 87 million, is, just correct me, is that, if I'm wrong, is that under Chapter 10, and is that being administered by State Board?
No, I honestly don't remember what chapter. Okay. It's under. It's in Prop 1. That was 100 million for groundwater. That is administered by the department.
Oh, your department.
Yep, the vast majority is still there. 86 and change.
I think it would be really helpful to ask the staff that are working on that to come and give us an update on, you know, where they are in the process and when they anticipate releasing that money. Thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing no other, are there any public comments on this item? If you could state your name for the record, that'd be great. Okay. Court reporter today.
Good morning, Commissioners. Jennifer Clary, Clean Water Action. And thank you very much. This is a good presentation, although those flow charts kind of are hard on my eyes a little bit, but maybe younger eyes have an easier time of it. I wanted to say that I think that the structure of these BMPs are really good. I think they're really clear and easy to follow. I'm still reading them in some detail. But one thing I'm looking at is the difference between the BMPs and the guidance that's been issued to date, and the idea that the stakeholder engagement piece is a guidance. The guidance documents are really sparse, and I'm hopeful that when the guidance documents for tribal engagement and stakeholder engagement come out, that they're going to be much more robust. I understand that DWR doesn't want to prescribe stakeholder engagement because there's a lot of different models, but they actually have a lot of experience and in-house capacity with all the facilitation that they are funding, and I would truly hope that we're going to get a better something more robust that I'm looking at in the guidance. So that's what I'm looking at now, and we'll be submitting written comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Hi, Juliet Christian Smith with the Union of Concerned Scientists. So we're really happy to see the best management practices come out. We think that they provide a lot of important details and are putting some meat on the bones here. Particularly BMPs 1 through 3, we strongly support the staff drafts. When we get to BMP 4, the water budget, one of the things that we're really interested in is making sure people understand the steps of the process. So what is different about SGMA is that there needs to be a different level of transparency and engagement with stakeholders, and it needs to address specific undesirable results that have been called out in the legislation. And so when setting, for instance, a sustainable yield, that needs to be back calculated. So first, what local GSAs need to do is decide what is an undesirable result, what threshold, where does it become undesirable? Then they need to ensure that that doesn't have negative effects on particular people or things. And if it does, in some cases, they might need to reassess that threshold. then they need to think about the uncertainty around that threshold. How likely is it that they might miss it and therefore put themselves out of compliance? And then they have to think about, does this threshold conflict with our neighboring basin or interconnected basin? And then they have to think about whether there's existing state laws that address this issue. And then after all of those things are considered, they get to what is the sustainable amount of pumping from this aquifer that will not trigger any of these undesirable results as defined by this community in this place. And I will tell you that on the ground, being engaged in the San Joaquin Valley, a lot of folks are starting at the end with the safe yield that they have already decided on locally and are working backwards. And that might work in some cases, but in some cases that's it may not work, and then they get a long way down the line before they go back. So we think that there's really a need to focus not just on the what, but the how, the process. With BMP-5, the modeling piece, you brought up the issues around proprietary software again, and I just want to state that I think our interest is really simple. It's that you're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts. We want to create a system where there's a collaborative scientific fact base, a collaborative modeling effort, not combat science. And I've heard the Public Policy Institute of California, Stanford University, UC Water, all talking about this issue, that because we are one of the only states that's going to look at groundwater with different models, we really need to understand how they're going to talk to one another.
Thank you very much, Juliet. Thanks. Any other public comment?
I'd like to ask a question. So thank you for articulating the modeling a lot better than I did. The yield, though, sometimes solving a problem by working backwards can be useful. I wasn't quite clear on what you were saying there. If you establish what you believe your yield to be necessary, mm-hmm. then you take the steps to make that happen without the damaging consequences.
You could back calculate it that way too. Okay. Either way, but I just think that there's a series of steps that, unless you're pretty familiar with the legislation, may not be clear that there are actually these undesirable results. You have to set a minimum threshold. Mm-hmm. The minimum threshold needs to go through some kind of public review process, and that's what the communications plan and the stakeholder engagement is intended to do. And you're also, the Department of Water Resources has this requirement to look across basins and make sure one basin is not jeopardizing another basin. So it behooves you to do the same thing.
So from where I'm sitting, if you're looking at the yield at the end, but you're really in denial about the process, then of course it's not going to work. But if you're if you're really innovative and prepared to make substantial changes where necessary, then it actually might be a way to get to what you have to do. But mm-hmm. but I appreciate it.
Great, thank you, Juliet. Trevor, you want a final? You got to get to some.
So, I mean, I think both of these points are really good ones that you bring up on kind of having the end in mind, but yet you have to work through the process. Because we've seen that where already that folks have a overdraft number. And that's great. That's actually good for the purposes of acknowledging in the room that there's a deficit and that they have to work on that. But Julia, it's very correct that there is a public process and there is an outreach component, and it's absolutely a requirement of the Act and the regulations. And so that should not be forgotten then in terms of working through that component to develop your plan. So I just kind of wanted to reiterate both of those are really good points, and we see both of those items moving through forward. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Trevor. Okay, now I'm going to check with the court reporter. Would you like a couple-minute break? Or you're okay. We're probably going to go until 12 or 12:30. So the next item on the agenda is number 11, which is our WSIP regulations. And I've got Dave Gutierrez is going to kick us off. And just to remind everybody, this is we're going to have public comment cards for this item. And again, we're considering the regulations that we've been considering for some time. We had a public information meeting last week, and we went over some language issues with the regulations and had some suggestions. So this is staff returning to address some of the issues that we talked about, as well as look to the commissioners for our approval of sending this out for a formal public comment. And what we would be sending out would be the previous draft redline version staff has provided, plus any edits that staff might be proposing or that we might make here today. With that, go for it, Dave.
Okay, thank you very much, commissioners. So first of all, I'd like to acknowledge that I think we are coming off of a very successful meeting on November 10th. And I say successful because we received very specific direction from the commission on how to, in some cases, make changes to a draft that we had for discussion purposes, and in other cases, don't make changes and go in the same direction that staff was going before the meeting. So as a result of that, we took that information, we took the direction that we received from the commission, and that resulted in a few adjustments to what we presented on November 10th. And in some cases, these are actually very, in most cases, actually, I think it's very simple changes that we were asked to make. Things like grammatical corrections. There is one piece that we had a difficult language that we had to construct regarding compliance obligations, mitigation and compliance obligations. And then in a few instances, I think commission directed us in one way after we kind of went back to the office and kind of wrote it out. Well, it's not exactly that way. And so there's some of that where maybe we didn't completely do what we had said on November 10th. So in today's meeting, we actually are having a very short presentation for you. And what we're going to do today is Joe Yun will actually be presenting the modifications and adjustments that we are making as a result of the meeting from last week. So these clarifications and in some cases changes will be discussed to the commission today. In some cases, we're actually going to show the language. In other cases, we're going to describe it. After that, after Joe makes this short presentation, we're going to be, of course, wanting clarification between commission and Joe during the presentation. We're going to ask for public comment, and then we're going to do just like we did last week, where we're going to want to engage the commission to the commission staff if there's any further direction. And then possibly at the end of the meeting, depending on how public comment goes and how commission interaction goes with the commission staff, we may be asking for a motion for us to actually release a public draft for comment. So with that, I'm going to let Joe come up, and he's going to go through the changes that we've made. And we certainly invite to ask you to ask any questions of clarification during this part. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. I just want to reiterate, so the base document is the regulations in the red line form that are posted online right now and that we reviewed last week.
So as Dave said, I'm going to walk you through some of the things that we're changing since last we met. I'll start with management of public benefit. This is a lot of cleanup work. We clarified the language in 6014. So it's clear there was a little confusion where we had singular contract and multiple contracts, and so we wanted to go back and clarify that. So we've inserted some text that makes it clear that you need to work with each of the appropriate state agencies, and that gets you into more than one contract. There was some confusion that we used. We had a discussion on the 10th about the use of may and shall, and we had a discussion with the state board on the 10th about what are some of the sensitivities we have to have with some of working with some of the other state agencies where. Our regulations telling another state agency what they're doing is sometimes problematic, and so we had to go back and look at the mays and shalls and make sure they all lined up with the appropriate parties. So we've done that. That's a quick tour for management of public benefit changes since last we spoke.
So real quick, Joe, so where did we – I'm just a little confused. Do we end up with may or do we end up with shall on the one that
– Both mays and shalls. What's important is that from that conversation that we had is that the mays refer to the agencies and the shalls refer to applicants and other things. So the agencies, and remember we talked about the agencies coordinating and working together outside of the regs and possibly establishing an MOU, and I think that's something we're pursuing, but that's outside the regs. So coordination and needing to report and wanting to report and will report, I think all that stuff will happen. It's just that in the regulation language, it is may. When I'm talking about, when we talk about the agencies may submit a report, the agencies may, there's a couple of different instances of may in that management of public benefit paragraph that refers to agencies.
So I got it. Okay.
In one instance, there was a shall and a may, and so it didn't make sense, like in conjunction with one another. So,
Commissioner Orth.
So to be clear, this can be obviously difficult to track unless we have some specificity here. In 6014, there was a provision that said prior to the execution of the contract, the administering agency may submit a draft of the contract to the commission. You've left that.
That is left.
You have not changed
yes,
that
correct.
To shall.
I have not changed
and,
that.
And the response to our concerns that were expressed is that you're going to try to address that through an MOU with the administering agencies so that we have some definition of process that allows us and the public to see the contract before it's finalized.
Think, yeah.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And Joe, I would, and we would have the opportunity in our funding agreement, right, to require, so if we're not requiring, I'm thinking of one specifically here where it says we're the administering agency may submit reports to the commission. We could require the applicant or the approved applicant to submit reports to us, regardless of whether we're requiring the Fish and Wildlife to do so.
Yes, you could. There's an issue somewhat with timing between the funding agreements and the agency contracts, because the funding agreements will run while the project is under construction. Once the project is constructed, your funding agreement is probably going to close, and at that point, the administering of public benefit contracts really take over in terms of producing benefit and administering that benefit. So we can, in the funding agreements, make those requirements, and I think that will work. I think in function, there is a timing issue with some of that, and the ability for the commission to keep that funding agreement open once you've expended all the funds.
I get that. So how do we then figure out, I mean, I guess through this MOU we're talking about?
I think that's going to be the mechanism where you and the public can have some assurances that, yes, the state agencies will come in and report to you, and you will get the information you need to function as we're trying to write it into the regs and not use the word shall in all cases.
Commissioner Herrera?
Sorry. I had a question. I think I spoke about this during our last meeting. There was language in there stating that the commission shall track the public benefits, and then it sort of alluded to the reports that may be provided. Is that word shall, is that still in there, or is staff proposing to change that? Shall track.
That shall is still there. We felt that if we changed it to may, it was too tentative language for what the commission wishes to do.
Any other questions? I would think that we'd want to make sure that we can require, as opposed to having to ask for, if we're required to track it, then I think in the funding agreement, I think we should require that. I get that once the money's expired, but doesn't mean we can't have an ongoing obligation in the agreement to submit a report, which though yeah. I assume have to submit to whatever managing department it is anyway. So
yeah, we can do that.
I don't know whether that requires a change or not, but
I'll look at it, and if I can strengthen that, I will.
Okay, because we've got, you know, six lines on what goes in the report, and then it's going to be up to another department to determine whether they and what kind of report they require or not. So anyway. Any other comments?
Okay, moving on to changes in scoring. So last time we talked, I think Commission asked us to increase the implementation risk score. So we went ahead and did that, and we redistributed the scores across the four components. And so on the slide before you, I'm just showing you what that looks like now. We've kept things in the same order. So public benefit ratio was highest before. It is still the highest. But we shaved off some points on the first two categories to pull that 5 points into implementation risk for a total of 15. So then all the subsequent changes in the language that needed to happen to make all that work have been made.
Okay. Questions, comments regarding, so we've tweaked the scoring based upon comments made at the last meeting. I understand, obviously, we're going to have public comment on all these issues as well. Okay, for now, we're good, Joe. Yeah.
One of the other comments that we talked about last time was the language for commissioners adjusting scores seemed a little cumbersome. Would it be easier to just insert a percentage? And so we went ahead and did that. We're allowing component scores to be adjusted up to 25% before the commission would ask staff to reevaluate and come back with a larger change if you wanted something larger than 25%.
Okay. This is the commissioner, some element of us making the decisions and staff's recommending and us having the ability to make some changes and also say, go back to the drawing board.
Yep.
Okay, we'll keep going.
All right. So we can spend some time here. existing environmental mitigation and compliance obligations. Last time, and this is the topic where we are still actively making changes. I'm still working with State Water Board and Fish and Wildlife as we kind of figure out how does this all work. So we talked last time about identifying a date to kind of bound or help determine or define that word existing and in existing environmental mitigation and compliance. And I had suggested that perhaps what we do is we say it's the date of the published model, since we're going to use the model as a tool in that regard, and got general agreement from the commission to go do that. I think we are proceeding with that. I think the discussions and the thoughts that we're having now are more where in the regulations do we do that and how do we best articulate that. We can certainly use the November 2nd, 2016 date, which we had just released the latest version of the CalSIM model run. When you see that in and of itself in the regulations, sometimes you stare at it and you say, well, what significance does November 2nd have? And so if there's a better way to articulate that, that's what we're working with now. But we can put in a date of some sort to kind of help bound that word existing. So we are working that. Section 003, the application item AA. So we talked last time and in October and November, we talked about the concept of making sure that there's disclosure and an easy way for folks to see what environmental mitigation compliance obligations are associated with what public benefits. And so we are adding text into this item of the regulations just to be more explicit as to what we're asking for and what the applicant needs to supply. So it's clear how that attachment should come in, so it'll do what we want it to do, which is an easy way for folks to see what compliance obligations match up with what benefits. So that language is happening. That may be the place where we put in that date that helps bound that term existing. So that's one of the thoughts we have right now that we still have to work through. Section 6004. You asked us in the quantification section of the regulations to reinstate the statutory language that said except for, I think it's 79753B. So that statutory language will come back in to the regulations as requested. into Section 6004. So the other parts of 6004, we are modifying text. So when we brought that language back in order to keep kind of the model language we had in there and some of the other language, we had to start moving things around. So we're making structural, moving paragraphs and making some structural changes to accommodate that change in the regulations. I think we are able to bring that statutory language back in, retain the things that we had, and make everything work. So I think we're pretty close to getting that done. Section 6013 is a section in the regulations that talks about funding agreement. And one of the things that we talked about in the context of existing environmental mitigation and compliance obligations on the 10th was trying to provide the applicant some certainty where they wouldn't have to keep remodeling and rerunning and redoing their allocation through time. And I think I spoke at that point and said, well, yeah, I think that makes sense because once the commission makes its initial determinations, you go through a whole process of getting all those 79755 requirements taken care of. And part of that is the agency contracts for administration of benefits. So by the time the applicant comes back to the commission, there shouldn't be a reason to rerun the model and have them reallocate. We should be adaptively managing the benefits at that point. And the applicant still needs to come to the commission and say, here's what's changed in that time on my project. And you can ask them questions and for whatever information you need, but we made sure that the language didn't somehow require them to redo the model at that point. We felt that was unnecessary. So we've clarified that language. As I said, we're still coordinating with the agencies and internally to try to get all this language correct and make everybody happy, but we are very close, and that's where we're headed at this point with mitigation compliance.
Commissioner, comments or questions? Commissioner Curtin? No, you're good.
Are you picking on me?
Commissioner Orth, well, there was a 45-minute discussion at the last meeting. So. Commissioner Orth.
I've already forgotten all of that.
It's, again, I'm sorry, but it's difficult to track this. I think conceptually I understand what you're proposing. It's a little bit different than I recall. I suggested last meeting that we modify the definition to eliminate the word existing and to make a specific reference to the statute. It doesn't sound like you're going to do that. It sounds like you're going to try to embed the statute reference in other places in the regs. And I don't know that I can get my brain wrapped around that conceptually yet. And then I think what I'm hearing is that in the determination of whether or not these are, in order to avoid association with existing mitigation and obligation, compliance obligations, we're going to run it against the latest version of CalSIM model, which is a November 2nd version. And if there are additional supplies, additional benefits provided above that baseline, then those would be fundable public benefits. Correct. But if they're just filling buckets or they don't create new supplies on top of the filled regulatory buckets, then we're gonna tell the applicant, you know, there are no additional benefits provided. Is that kind of what I'm hearing?
Yeah, for the big flow-related ones that are in the model. If there's other things out there, they will still need to disclose, and you'll still need to work through.
Yeah, good point. The distinction is CalSIM's going to look at flow.
Right.
There are other public benefits that they'll have to demonstrate through other mechanisms.
Right.
All right.
Is that clear, Dave?
Well, it's clearer.
Clearer, yeah. So
he'll believe it when he sees it, I think.
So real quick on the question about existing and leaving existing in, and I'm sorry to go over it again, Joe. So can you go over it again?
I think the commission has maintained for quite a while that you do not wish to pay for existing mitigation and compliance obligations, and I think that's where that word existing showed up. It was in the January version of the regulation, so it has been with us since the beginning. So there has been a long discussion about removing the temporal component for various reasons. We felt that with the use of the model as the tool and the disclosure piece and additional processing through, you know, the PBR appeal process, that there's enough pieces in here that we can leave the word existing in and move forward with everything that we have accumulated to date. So that, in a nutshell, I think that's my take on the word existing and why it's there. We can certainly pull it out. At this point, I'm not sure that it makes a huge distinction. I remember last time we had a discussion on the 10th where we talked a little bit about how existing can actually be kind of a protection for an applicant. So we went through those kinds of discussions. When we looked at changing the definition or just referring back to the code in the definition, the piece of code doesn't actually define mitigation and compliance. It uses those words, but it doesn't define it at all. So just referring back to the code didn't help. And that's why we brought back that specific statutory language back into 6004.
Okay.
So that's kind of the whirlwind of...
No, I get it, and I remember the takeaway is that the long discussion we had is that you're not going to have to rerun your model after, for purposes of the application.
Right.
There's a point in time.
Right.
All right.
Okay.
Moving on.
You know, I started looking at other things, so this is close to the end of my presentation. There were some things out there that you wanted us to, that came up in our conversation last time. There was a comment about the resiliency to the effects of climate change, which was a definition. I did go back through the documents, and we don't actually use that anywhere, and so that definition is now marked for deletion. Section 6010, between 6010 and 6013, there were inconsistencies. And in one place, we said only includes construction, and in the other place, it says construction and operation. So this came up in the context of, I think we're talking about mitigation and compliance on the 10th. It was part of a long conversation. So to make things consistent, we're changing things to construction and operation. So when we pay for something, it's consistent with your capital cost definition, I think. So everything is now consistent by making it clear that we're paying for permits, which includes construction and operation. I think that's that clarification. And then a lot of it is throughout the regulations, there are a lot of grammatical and typographical and consistency errors. We are going through and cleaning those up. I found the word "tis" this morning. It's things like that. Also, when we talked about non-monetized benefit, and I realized when we were trying to move that away from resiliency, it really should be non-monetized public benefit. So, you know, there's cleanup pieces like that we're taking care of. In addition, there were some things that were outside the regs or things that we talked about that we have made changes to, so I didn't want to, and I don't know if this is the right time to bring all this stuff up, but the simplification pieces that we talked about last time, those changes have all been made. There were no additions to that, so there's no additional changes to the regs. So the things like using your 2030 economic values and applying them to 2070 to save some effort in creating the economic future for 2070, those changes are all made. There was another piece about public participation, and there were some pieces outside the regulations that we told you we would be working on in terms of process. And so I didn't know if now would be the time, Tarn, did you want to talk a little bit about those pieces outside the regs, or did you want me to wait until I finish? Or?
Well, we do have a slide that's been added to the PowerPoint presentation that is available for the public and for the commissioners to reference. This is the first document that we actually have completed, but staff are working on additional, more text-informative documents that our aim is to have available and out to the public by the end of the week. So this will just really quickly, this will show you the timeline for essentially 2017 with the application process. So, of course, we have a pending OAL approval, and then it walks us through what the Water Commission staff and the commissioners will be doing, how the information will be provided to the public, and then what the opportunities for public input will be. This is the kind of high-level view, and again, we'll have more specifics by the end of the week. We, as you can imagine, have just been spread a little thin on some other items, but we appreciate everyone's patience while we're trying to draft this all up. So if you have any questions on the timeline, we're happy to talk on that too.
Okay.
Let me go back. Oh, did you just? So there were some things, as Dave mentioned, that we are not proposing to make changes to. Last time on the 10th, we talked a little bit about groundwater-dependent ecosystems in the definition of groundwater storage and as well as a priority ecosystem priority table. In looking at those changes, I don't think that the Fish and Wildlife is interested in changing their priority to include that, and so we're proposing not to make that change. When I looked at the definition and what the proposed language was, I think it said something like, I've got it somewhere, but it didn't help with the definition of a groundwater storage project. I thought that the groundwater dependent ecosystem part was probably covered, and it's not exclusionary, so calling it out didn't seem to help me much. So I looked at them and didn't really, not recommending making those changes. So one of the edits was in the groundwater storage project, means a design project that captures, infiltrates, injects, or recharges, direct or in lieu, water supplies into a groundwater basin for later use or to avoid or address undesirable groundwater results. And the edit part would be potentially by leaving the added groundwater in storage indefinitely. So that was the one edit, I just didn't think it was really helping there. But we weren't proposing to make that change. So those are the groundwater dependent ecosystem issue. The other thing that we talked about previously was the number of years in the drought that we would have folks analyze. As staff has talked about that, we want to look at how the projects perform during a drought, not necessarily a long drought. I think in the confines of the model, because all this data is coming out of the model, the longer your drought is, the less storage there's going to be. We just want to see in a drought how the projects function. So we would like to leave it at 3 years. That is the staff recommendation. Not sure that it helps in the analysis to extend those years.
Any commissioner comments or questions on either of the two here? Try to remember, Commissioner Orth.
Joe, on the groundwater dependent ecosystems, I guess the question is whether or not the Department of Fish and Wildlife would consider projects that support groundwater dependent ecosystems as consistent with these regs, and I'm going to assume that their unwillingness to modify their ecosystem priorities doesn't lead one to a conclusion that they don't support that.
No, I think
it, excuse me, it just I think it does get wrapped up in already, you know, enhancing groundwater conditions to improve the quantity and quality of riparian and floodplain habitats. There's an implied connection there. So that's one place where I think the connection, I'm probably agreeing with you. So I just want to go through this analysis and see if it makes sense to you.
Where were you reading from there?
And
Dave?
I'm looking at the Table 1 ecosystem priorities on page 33.
Got it.
It's number 9. And then the definition, you know, when we make a reference in the definition to, and this is groundwater storage definition.
It's 6.
41, page 6. To avoid or address undesirable groundwater results. My recollection is that surface water-groundwater interaction and thus groundwater-dependent ecosystems becomes wrapped up in that undesirable result. So, you know, I'm trying to make a case in my mind as I talk through this that the omission of that edit doesn't necessarily abandon the concept. The concept's already embedded elsewhere.
Correct. That's what that was our read. The other thing I would point out on page 32 is ecosystem priority number 8, maintain and restore groundwater and surface water interconnection to support in-stream benefits in groundwater-dependent ecosystems.
Okay, yeah, I missed that, but that's even clearer. So, all right, thank you.
No.
Okay, no further questions or comments? We can move on. Questions or comments?
Questions. If you have no questions for me, I think we can move to public comment.
Yeah, I think we may as we get public comment. So why don't we move into that, and we'll take public comment. Again, there are cards to submit. We have a reporter here, so we're doing that for her benefit. If you could state your name up front, that'd be great, and who you're with. So we'll have public comment now on this item. So it is an action item. And the proposed action from staff is to take formal action to the commission to send to public comment, to formal public comment, a draft of the regs that is on the website with the changes that are proposed and have been described in this presentation, as well as technical and minor non-substantive editing as well. So that's before us. If there are public comment, I've got some cards here. We'll start with Jennifer Clary, Clean Water Action, followed by Kyle Jones, who's always with Jennifer Clary, by the way.
Well, you know, I was late today, so he's sitting in the back. I just don't understand that. Jennifer Clary, Clean Water Action. I'm surprised to be the first speaker, but just reviewing this, I want to say that I really appreciate the work of staff on this. They took this up at the last minute, and they've done a really good job, but I feel like it's incomplete because 40% of the scoring is not well-defined. So you have the feasibility analysis, which is based on total project benefits, not on public benefit. That seems inappropriate, and it's worth 15 points. And then you have this resiliency piece, which is wholly undefined and unquantified and wholly subjective. And that makes this into a beauty contest for me rather than something that I can look at and understand. And since you've also reduced, you're not doing real drought resiliency because you're only doing a 3-year drought. A surface storage project can make it through 3 years, but groundwater storage can make it through 5 years. So naturally, we'll do something that makes surface storage more attractive. You're making climate change, or changing the definition of climate change, making into a very small piece of resiliency. That's a critically important piece of how these projects operate. And you've removed the independent technical review requirement, which could give some of us at least some comfort that we're getting a really independent objective review of this process. So I feel like we have an unfinished project process here and an unfinished set of regulations, and that's what I'll be putting in my comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Good morning, Kyle Jones of Sierra Club, California. I mostly just wanted to comment on process today. I'm a bit concerned about the vote you'll be taking now, given that we don't have any language, and I know it's been a quick turnaround, and I know staff's been working really hard, but to the extent that this could be deferred if possible, I would appreciate that, because there's still being things that are being worked out, and we don't know how that language is going to be. And we will have a 15-day comment period, but the extent that you won't hear any of that input today, I think, is disconcerting. I can't make substantive comments if, like you guys, I don't know which may is may and which shall is a shall. And so I would just hope that if it's possible to consider moving something forward, and similar to how there was a call the last time this was done, and that we could participate that way, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kyle. Got Jim Watson followed by Adam Robin.
Jim Watson with the Sites Project, and again, I would like to also echo the comments about staff support to, especially when it comes to the environmental mitigation compliance obligation, taking a hard look at it, and the commission looking at it. It is had been a serious concern, and we feel that with what is being proposed as those changes, it is moving in the right direction to address our concerns, and we really appreciate the staff and the commission taking a serious look at it and fixing it before the regulations get approved. So I want to thank you, and I want to thank the staff for all their effort to work on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim. Adam Robin, followed by Juliet Christian-Smith.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Adam Robin. I'm with the Association of California Water Agencies, and as always, really appreciate the opportunity to provide comments on the Water Storage Investment Program. As you know, Aqua represents over 435 public water agencies. We actively participated in the development of Proposition 1, and we've been engaged on the development of these regulations for almost 2 years now. I want to focus my comments today on the environmental compliance obligations and mitigation measures piece. I think, like Mr. Watson, we're cautiously optimistic about the changes that have been outlined here. As you know, we think that ensuring that the commission maintains its full discretion over these costs, which are fundable under Water Code Section 79753B, is critical to ensuring that this program is able to realize its goals of improving the operation of the state's water system and providing net improvements in ecosystem and water quality conditions. So again, I think at the changes as outlined, we're cautiously optimistic. We would support a clear restatement of the commission's authority to fund these costs, the exception in Section 79753B that says that the commission can't fund costs associated with environmental compliance obligations or mitigation measures, except for those that are associated with providing the public benefits. It was said during the staff presentation that it's been clear over time that the commission has expressed a preference to not fund existing compliance obligations or costs associated with existing compliance obligations. I think that's true, but I've been following the discussions pretty closely, and I think there's been a clear recognition among the commissioners that in order for this program to work, you need to have the authority to, at your discretion, fund costs that are associated with providing the public benefits. So that's just a slight addition to what I heard staff say earlier today. Secondly, I think we are, again, cautiously optimistic that CalSIM can, the use of the CalSIM model can provide a really useful tool to both the commission and the and project proponents as they present the public benefits of their project for potential funding by you all. We look forward to reviewing the draft language as soon as it's available. Really appreciate all of the efforts of the commission and staff to keep this process moving forward. Look forward to providing written comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. Juliet Christian-Smith, followed by Paul Wenger.
Thank you. Hello again. If you could just take a look at, I think it was slide 7 of the changes. The first one, other, and the other changes was this change to section 6001. That was deleting the definition of resiliency. So I will say I am shocked. It was actually my comment that brought this up. And the context was that I was supporting the definition and asking for it to be strengthened, as it was the only definition of resiliency. Without a definition of resiliency, without a quantification of resiliency, mm-hmm. it's going to make it very hard for an organization that is focused on science-driven decision-making to support these regulations as currently written. Because we have no guarantee that science will play the role that it needs to when we're looking at water storage that can last for a century or more, We know how the system is changing. We know we're losing snowpack, and we're expected to lose up to 80% by the end of the century. You all have spoken eloquently about it. So if we aren't actually taking that into account, and based on these changes, I don't think we can argue that we have. We're in a difficult position. So resiliency, without a definition, could just be water supply improvements by another name. And I think that would bring up the exact same legal problems that the water supply improvements criteria presented and why it was originally removed. So we really need to think about that a little bit harder, I think. Thanks.
Thank you, Juliet. Paul Wenger, followed by Doug Obigi.
Good morning, or nearly afternoon, commissioners. My name is Paul Wenger. I'm president of California Farm Bureau, representing over 30,000 farmer members, and good to see you here this morning. I can say that we've been working on a lot of these issues for a long time, going well back before 2009 when we finally got the initial water bond that was going to be proposed for 2010, and it took 3 years of drought to be able to get it passed in 2014. I'm proud to be able to say that I was a signatory with Governor Brown in support of Proposition 1. We were out in the field. In fact, the governor was at my farm talking about climate change and resiliency and the fact that we need to have increased water storage. So I guess I'm a little concerned when I hear some of the things today, and Commissioner Orth, when you said it's a little clear, I guess maybe a little clearer about Section 6004 and existing. The statute's very clear. When it comes to existing mitigation measures and other things, they cannot be considered for Prop 1 funding except if it's in the public benefit. I mean, it's pretty clear in the statute. And I know it's after the fact. We had just a broad section of business groups, water agencies, environmental groups, and others that supported Prop 1. It went to a resounding victory at the polls. And as I go around, no one really understands what you all are doing here. Going through all the day in, day out to figure out and define what a public benefit is, everybody's going, where's the water? What are we doing? We had a really good last year. We had some rainfall, and we weren't able to take advantage of it. And so they don't understand the processes. I know I understand the processes, and my hat's off to you for going through this. But words do have meaning, and clearly the statute was very clear. If it's an existing, except for a public benefit, it's up to you to define what that public benefit. Beyond that, it should be fundable for this program. And while some of the previous speakers said they're cautiously optimistic, I think you just have to say, let's take words on their meaning. It's not may, shall, or something else. If it isn't a public benefit, even if it's an existing mitigation measure, it should be funded. So thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you very much.
Commissioner, I want to make one quick comment just in response to your comment, Mr. Wenger. When I said it was a little clearer, I think I intended to mean that what the staff explanation is a little clearer. I'm not sure that we've got this right yet, so I'm not expressing support of where we're at. I was just saying it's a little clearer on what they're trying to do here.
Right. The comment was made that, you know, staff was trying to do what the commissioners intended, but I think the commissioners will do today what they intend to do. And so sometimes staff might make recommendations, but it was really up to you all to carry out the wishes of the voters. So, and I think that's pretty clear. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Doug Obigi, followed by Rachel Zwillinger.
Good morning. Doug Obigi from the Natural Resources Defense Council. Thank you for the opportunity to be here again. I really want to extend my appreciation to staff and to commissioners for hanging through this process. I don't think we're there yet, but we're making progress. I want to focus really going back to the language of the statute that projects are supposed to be ranked based on the magnitude of public benefits. The public benefits are enumerated, and water supply for agencies is not a public benefit. Nor, in our view, is paying for existing mitigation and compliance obligations, because you are effectively trading an improvement for the environment for someone else's water supply. There are two problems, in my view, with both the resiliency element and the existing mitigation and compliance element. One, on page 18, the physical and economic benefits summary table that is part of the resiliency consideration and scoring includes the amount of water delivered in dry years and end of September storage. Even though we've struck that from the text of the regulation, it's still part of what is being considered for resiliency. And those are fundamentally issues of private benefits, not public benefits. And the same is true with the language in the resiliency and in Section 6003. A lot of those criteria are private benefits. So the commission, the regulations are putting the commission in a place of scoring projects based in part on private benefits, contrary to the statute. With respect to the existing mitigation and compliance obligations, I find the current language unacceptable. I believe that the statute was clear that we were supposed to be getting real improvements in environmental conditions. That doesn't mean meeting existing obligations. That means going above and beyond what we have today. And when NRDC campaigned for Prop 1, when we supported Prop 1, when we helped enact Prop 1, we did so on the belief that we were going to see real improvements and that we wouldn't be paying for existing mitigation and compliance obligations. So I hope that when we actually get to see language, that we, the commission will carefully consider comments and will consider, even if you have to miss the December deadline, getting it right rather than rushing to get it by the deadline. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. Commissioner, comments or questions? Rachel, I'm sorry. Didn't see you back there.
I'm Rachel Zwillinger with Defenders of Wildlife. Substantively, I'd like to reiterate some of the points that you've already heard, that we're very concerned about project scoring incorporating the resiliency component for 25% of the total score when it's not clear that those are public benefits and actually seems to authorize ranking of projects based on private benefits. We share the concerns that Doug just expressed about existing mitigation and compliance obligations. You know, it's hard to know what that looks like, not having seen the newly proposed language, but the description left me feeling concerned about that language, that it's inconsistent with the statute. On management of public benefits, I still believe that there are insufficient opportunities for public input, both with respect to the contracts and particularly with respect to the adaptive management process, and continue to request improvements there because that's a critical component to making sure these public benefits materialize in the future. Procedurally, I would echo the concerns that Kyle Jones from Sierra Club expressed about your voting to send a draft out to public comment when it seems like that draft is not done and we don't actually know what's in it. In addition to the changes to the regulations, I'm concerned that there are probably also changes to the technical reference document, which is a part of the regulations that we perhaps haven't discussed today. I don't know if that's the case, but I think there were some problems with that document that I hope have been addressed. And so I would similarly urge a delay of this vote until there's an opportunity to review the newly proposed language.
Great. Thank you very much, Rachel. Any other public comment? I see Jason coming forward.
Let's see. I think it's still good morning. Good morning. My name is Jason Gianquinto with the Semi-Tropic Water Storage District. We're a proponent of the Tulare Lake Project, and I do want to applaud the commission for putting more emphasis on resiliency. You know, given the uncertainty of water futures that we're looking at, I think you need to provide more emphasis on the resiliency and adaptation ability for projects to work together. You know, that's how Semi-Tropic has been able to get through the drought we've dealt with over the over the last 8 years, basically, is because we have a very flexible system that be able to provide for our own needs and also for our bankers north and south of the Delta. So you have a difficult task at hand about how to score and rank projects. I understand the public benefits are a huge component, but the resiliency aspect is something you really can't model. At least as a project proponent, we do not have the tools or resources to really analyze what that resiliency looks like when you couple North and South Delta storage programs, surface water storage with groundwater. That's a very complex thing to analyze. And it's really tied to what is your assumptions based for conveyance through the Delta? What does that look like? And that's not something, at least, that we're willing to step up to. But I think you have to, you know, probably push back on staff or add support to staff to be able to say what projects provide us the best opportunity for a future under this water supply investment program. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jason. Okay, Commissioner Quintero.
You know, a couple things. One of them is when we removed or you're proposing removal of resilience from the definitions, yet we have resiliency in our scoring. And I that's a disconnect for me.
I guess that's a question for staff.
And I also want to say that when I think about resiliency, I think of it in terms of the resiliency being able to be available for the public benefit as well. You know, the resiliency adds to the public benefit opportunity. So,
right. So, as we're using resiliency, maybe a better way to say it is the definition no longer fit how we were using resiliency. The definition was resiliency to climate change, and it articulated resiliency to climate change. I think the way we're using resiliency, it's in a broader context, and it is to an uncertain future, which includes climate change, which is part of that. So the pieces that we're looking at and the things that we're doing are no different. It's just that definition no longer fit, and so we had marked it for deletion. If you would like us to relook at that definition and work with it, that's another option that we can try to do.
Commissioner Ball?
Yeah, I agree. I had exactly the same question. I don't know how you can have a major scoring component as being resiliency without having a definition. And I think what you just explained was not why it should be removed, but why it should be redefined. And I would like to see a redefinition of this in accordance with what you just said. I think it is a mistake to take it out.
Okay.
Yeah, and I also know, I mean, I was the one that brought up the comment about last week from the 3 years to something else, because I do think of three, it's strange, but in the current context, 3 years is no longer a drought. 3 years feels normal to have low rainfall. And so, I mean, you see what I'm saying. And I think that, and I realize that the language to this was written prior to us entering into this extended drought period. But the reality is I continue to be concerned that we make decisions about something that really is going to be useful, you know, and in clearly changing precipitation eras.
So on that one, I think one thing we should keep in mind that the way we're going to be calculating this particular category drought is it's subjective. And so whether we pick 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, or whatever, we got to stay consistent, and that's all we're trying to do, is stay consistent. 3 years gives us a direction of what a particular project is going to endure in terms of a drought. Is it an exact number? We don't need an exact number. All we're trying to do is a direction of how a particular project's going to behave during a drought. So it's not, what we're trying to do is kind of get away from the exactness of the number and instead a subjectivity criteria of what a drought is going to, how it's going to affect the project.
Commissioner Ball.
It doesn't matter to us too much whether it's 1 year, 3 year, 5 years. We're more.
So if it doesn't matter, then I think the difference between 3 and 5 is that 3 is something that could be more easily achieved than 5. 5, in my mind, puts a stress on the existing system that gives it a different potential outcome than 3. So if it's just as easy to go with 5 as it is 3, I'd actually prefer to see 5 because I think it's more valuable to look at a stress to the system above something that is normal. Because I do agree with the comment, I don't know who made it, that you know with the number of droughts that we've been in that have lasted 3 years, that seems to be something that our system is capable of dealing with. So as we look at adding water supply to the system, it'd be nice to know when that system is truly stressed beyond what we already know, what that result might be. So I'd prefer to see 5.
Okay, and I don't think we have a huge preference whether it's 3, 5. Just remember, we're talking about subjectivity. I also don't necessarily agree that it's going to help a groundwater program versus a surface storage. Whether it's 3 or 5, that's not going to make a difference. Whether it's a groundwater or surface storage, it's going to have more of whether this particular project is tied to a system or not. Whether it's flexible, the volume that it's actually going to have in terms of the volume of water. and you know, the specifics of how it's providing project benefits. So maybe
is there anyone in the commission who feels strongly about it being three? Otherwise,
No, I wasn't actually going to weigh in on that. But in terms of the 3 to 5, the project proponents will have a higher standard, obviously, of some sort, to prove their projects are actually as resilient, although we haven't decided what resilient is, as I would like to see. So I'm not, we'll probably hear about that. Maybe we want to get another round just quickly. But what I wanted to raise, I think the idea of resiliency was pretty much along the lines that Commissioner Quinteros was mentioning. For me, resiliency does mean more water. And when you say it that way, it sounds like, well, it's more water for public use. But there are 5 categories of public benefits, one of them being emergency response, and the other being the big one being ecosystem benefits. That's the way I'm looking at it, in terms of we have a requirement to look at the public benefits, and I can't see how having more water stored appropriately with the ability to move it cannot help public benefits.
And the way we look at that is, so resiliency is tied, in our opinion, to public benefits. If you have a project exactly. that's more resilient, that's more flexible, remember what we're doing here. We're trying to estimate what a project benefit is in the future. And we're talking about an uncertain future. So I think I've said it before, but it's important to understand that the project benefits that we're defining are most likely not going to be the project benefits that are there in 2050. That's why we're going to be adaptive. If you have a more resilient project that's more flexible, that's tied to a system, we're going to be able to make modifications and make better adaptability to a future project benefit than if we weren't. So it's our opinion that resiliency is absolutely tied to the project benefits.
So, okay, that clarifies that for me. I don't know about the definition, why taken out.
Certainly add the definition. Okay. I mean, we felt the existing definition was obviously not, it had changed. It had changed because of the course of the discussion that we had. We also felt that we didn't necessarily need it because it's already defined in how we're going to actually score it. We could easily, I think, put back a definition that will actually adjust to the way that we're actually going to score resiliency. I don't think that's...
Well, that seems to make some people more confident in it. So those are the 2 comments I had. I'm not sure about the 5 versus the 3. I'm not sure what that means in terms of analysis, in terms of cost for applications. I mean, I'm concerned about we're going to have such rigorous analysis that the projects that are not over a large scale they'll just throw up their hands and say, I'm not sure how this is going to work. I don't even know if I can apply.
Where exactly is this in the regs, Joe? The reference to 3 or 5. Sorry to put you on the spot, but it'd be nice to be looking at it.
Sorry about that.
I've got Commissioner Orth after Commissioner Curtin.
I'd like to close this loop.
Yeah, 26, capital letter D, I think, is what we're looking at. So the way we wanted to use this, it should be using data that they're already generating in the model we've asked for. So it shouldn't be any more work, really, for you to look at 3 or 5.
Shouldn't be?
Could not be.
This is on page 26, uppercase D, 4 lines in, 3 lines in. Danny, are you looking for feedback from anyone in particular on the question of whether it's...
Nobody in particular, no. But
yeah.
There's no feedback. We're good.
I missed that.
I was asking if he was asking anyone in the public in particular whether...
My general impression is that the big projects that are mostly represented here will, as Joe says, we'll probably not have that big of a deal, but I'm not sure about some of the smaller projects, which we really haven't heard much from, except I wouldn't actually call it a smaller project, but the semi-tropic project, which is a pretty big project. So I think resiliency is going to include a lot of small projects ultimately.
Commissioner Orth, Commissioner Quintero.
I think on this point, And I still want to circle back to the environmental mitigation topic, which will make everybody groan further. But I think on this point, David, it's already been suggested that we need to put a definition of resiliency in. We need to tie it back to public benefits. We need to explain how it's going to be considered. And I think that's embedded in that section where we talk about resiliency, but a definition and scoping that maybe responds to a lot of the uncertainty that we have and you've heard from the public comment. I guess I'm a bit indifferent on the three versus five. I'm assuming that, you know, none of the project proponents running up and saying that we prefer three or we prefer five, which is what others have invited, means that they may too be indifferent. Commissioner Ball is correct. I mean, five is a greater stress test analysis. We're looking at how the project could be used for public benefits at the beginning and the end of now proposed a five-year drought. Mm-hmm. Again, I guess it's a greater stress test analysis. But as you pointed out, we're really just doing project comparison at this point, right? These are hypothetical numbers to do a compare of project A to project B based on a drought year sensitivity or drought condition sensitivity. My reaction last week was at five, based on the experience that we've had, everything will be empty. So I guess that's why I'm somewhat indifferent here. But if, again, absent hearing from the public, and given where some of the commissioners have made good arguments, I can see five being fine.
Commissioner Dobosky.
I just want to kind of repeat myself that on the compliance and mitigation, I would support language that is consistent with the statute. I think that's critical. I think there was a reason that that was put in there. And I went through the process also back in 2009, and I know the importance of this statute. So I just want to say I want to support that.
Great. And that's what our plan is, to repeat what's consistent with the statute back in the regulations.
So since the comment's been made a number of times, I'm trying to close loops as we go on the 3 to 5 years.
So 3 to 5 and then resiliency definition are the ones.
It sounds like five, but there was a bit of no one's coming up, but I want to give people a final opportunity to come up on that if they want to address
it.
3 to 5.
I mean, part of the reason I bring it up is I serve on a board in Marin County. A 3-year drought, we can survive. A 5-year drought, we're going to have to change the way we operate drastically. And I guess that's what I'm looking at with these projects, is that, and I think it's valid to have the proponents talk about how are we going to do this in an extended dry, because I think it's the normal that we're seeing coming up. And that's all. It's not, and I think it'll still do a side-by-side comparison for us, but I also think that it highlights the seriousness with which we are all looking at our future. And I just think it's not, so I would ask that we do that.
Okay, Commissioner Ball.
Well said. I agree with that. I think that we already know what's going to happen in a 3-year drought. We just went through it. We know that we're just about at the bottom. So why do we want to put something in there that we already know the answer to? I'd actually like to know that going forward that we have more resiliency, more ability to deal with an extended drought. And so without going to five, I don't think we're going to learn anything. So I think three is completely worthless. I think that five starts to get to a point where we may learn something, and I think I would advocate for five strongly.
Mr. Dobosky?
I wouldn't mind hearing from some of the proponents on this issue of the three versus five.
My name is Jason Gianquinto with Semitropic. Just kind of a comment. I think we're kind of indifferent on three versus five. I think what's more pertinent is what were the years looking like up to that 3-year drought or 5-year drought. Was storage full? Was it not full? Where are you? So if you just say 5-year drought for a stress test, I would assume storage is full. Can we get through that 5-year period? Well, you can probably get through us making assumptions, but what did it look like before you got into that? And so you want us to identify what hydraulic period we look at for the analysis. Maybe you want to specify, we want these specific years, It has a five-year drought window, so we can see how it lines up. So we're not picking and choosing or artificially creating a drought scenario. So that's what I'm mostly concerned when I see that three versus five is what was leading up to that drought being triggered.
Thank you, Jason.
I was assuming we'd start with a full, everybody would start from a full storage stamp.
That's what I was thinking, too,
starting
yeah.
point.
Marguerite.
Good afternoon. Marguerite Patil, Contra Costa Water District proponent, Los Vaqueros Reservoir Expansion, one of the CalFID projects. So I'm just not sure it's totally clear to everybody. When we meet the requirements in the regulations, we're going to do a 82-year simulation in CalSim. You hear us talk about CalSim. It's going to include a wide range of droughts, three-year droughts, single-year droughts, five-, six-year droughts. It's all there. So it's whatever you want us to sort of highlight in the application and talk about, we can do that just from the analysis we're already doing. And so this is just sort of on top of what's already required. So for folks not using that CalSim hydrology, it's a little maybe more confusing how they would do that. But if you're using CalSim in the records and in the tools you provided for us, we can extract whatever you need to show the full range. So hopefully that's clear. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it is. Thank okay. you very much. Sounds like sold on 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, because it's there.
It's fine, yeah. If I'm with Commissioner Orth. I mean, somewhat indifferent.
Can I ask staff, and Marguerite makes a very good point, that, okay, some of our projects, applicants aren't going to have to use CalSim.
No, but they'll still have to use the climate change hydrology that we're going to provide.
And that'll still have the windows.
That's going to have that 100 years of record. And I think Marguerite actually said it better than we should have said it that way. It's there. So you just tell us what do you want to pull out, and they're going to pull it out.
Okay, so 5 years, and then finishing up on the discussion on existing, Commissioner Orth.
I continue to be very troubled by the conversation and the difference of opinions that are being raised here on the environmental mitigation and compliance obligations language. I think I will agree that, you know, the word existing has been with us for a while. And I still don't like it, to be honest. I think the safest thing for us to do, and I'm going to repeat what I said last Thursday, is to modify the definition so that the reference to environmental mitigation measures and compliance obligations, the definition is as stated in 79753B of the Water Code. I think your application language, and is it 601 or 60, is it 604 or 6014? Pardon? The definition, it.
Where's the page?
Okay, let me.
You're looking for the 604 language.
Let me find it.
Yeah, I'm looking too.
Yes, thank you. So I think the definition should reference the statute. I think my point was that I believe the determination of language on page 25, there seems to be general support and agreement with using the CalSim method to determine whether or not you're adding new additional benefits. I'm comfortable with that. But I think when we get ourselves wrapped up into this existing language, we've heard the arguments, and I'm sympathetic to them. I think the intent was that we were going to pay for environmental mitigation measures and compliance obligations associated with the provision of the public benefits that we're investing in. So somehow we've created an exclusion rather than an inclusion. And I think the safest thing to do is to tie that back to the the statutory language.
I think the way that we're designing it right now, or the way we're thinking to do it, is first our idea was to put the statutory language on page 25 to make it very clear, without the word existing, that pretty much word for word the way it's in the statutes in the beginning. And then from there, the idea would be to then the next step is sub out the idea about the CalSIM model, and that the CalSIM model really is defining the baseline for flows. And then from there, we've already identified that the applicants actually have to outline what is existing compliance obligations that are already out there, and then what are you doing above and beyond that. And I think one of the applicants said, and I think it's absolutely true, that it's going to be the commission's discretion to figure that out later, because we can't do it in the regulations. And so that's the way we have, that's the way that we're intending to go right now, that we're having, we're taking one of them, the flow, with the CalSIM, which is one of the most complex ones. That's the baseline, and let's not argue about that anymore. Above that is the public benefits. But you're still stuck with the other ones. They're going to have to outline it. Or if they're not using CalSIM and it's a smaller project, they're going to have to outline that. And it's going to come back to the commission. They're going to outline what a compliance obligation is. And it's going to be up to the commission to say yes or no, that they agree or they don't agree that that's, in fact, a compliance obligation. So we're not out of the woods of the commission making these tough decisions later. You're still going to have to do that. We're just trying to make one little piece a little bit easier for you on the flow for CalSIM.
Commissioner Curtin.
Yeah, so this is great because we've been discussing this for almost 2 years, and we're pretty much where we started. But if I could do this without numbers and so on and so forth, what we have is a situation where we kind of implied by, as the commission, that, God, we don't want to pay for somebody who has a responsibility to fix this problem and then just use us in some really clever scheme to get us to pay for it. I think we made that pretty clear. So the real question is, for me, and I think you laid it out earlier on, and I want to thank Adam in a way for capsulizing it. The idea is that when you make your submission, you're supposed to show us what benefits you would provide if the existing mitigations were already met. They don't have to be met, but if they were met, here's what ours would add on top of that. So if for some reason they haven't been met, and we still provide public benefits, I mean, I'm okay with that. The idea that we're going to say there's an existing benefit, therefore we can't fund your project, that doesn't exactly work for me. And it's not going to be an exact science. But if it's clear that we're being gamed by some nefarious agency that refuses to pay for its public benefits that it's required to pay for, well, we can say, no, that doesn't work. That's the way I see it. And it's, I mean, I'm getting completely lost by the 603s and the 4409s and whatever. If that's the intent and it is honestly reflected in the regs, I'm for them. And, you know, we have a motion. At some point, we're going to have to move on this motion.
Mr. Baker.
I think I'm just going to add a technical comment, which is on page 5, there's a definition of existing environmental mitigation and compliance obligations. So I'm not sure how that, what we've been talking about, I think might require a tweaking or something in that definition.
Page
5 at the top, 31. So if I'm tracking the discussion here,
32, or at least on the new one.
Or 32, well.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, 32, sorry, 32. Then I think there needs to be some truing up or something. I don't know.
And I think what we're trying to do is actually, we're trying to more address it on page 25, because it's how we're implementing it is what's most important. I mean, you've heard today, you've heard several different folks say how clear the definition and the statutes were. Well, it's clear to them, but it's also clear that they have a different opinion of what that definition is. So I'm not sure what clear is. So what we're trying to do is, you know, we've defined it on a definition, and we're trying to go towards the commission's desires of not to pay for this, you know, dangerous word of existing compliance obligations. But more importantly, we're trying to tell you on page 25 of how to get there. And the way you get there is, number one, if you're going to run CalSIMS and you do a flow model, then it's above and beyond that. That only takes care of one little piece. After that, it's going to be up to the applicants, whether they're a large project or small project, whether you're a project up into the watershed somewhere. You're going to have to define those compliance obligations that you've assumed. Then you're going to have to tell the commission what your project benefits. And then it's going to be up to the commission to decide, did they get it right or did they get it wrong? And so you're still stuck with having to make a difficult decision a year from now when you actually see these applications start coming in.
Commissioner Herrera.
I just have two comments. One, I just, because I haven't gone, you know, on the record on this particular item on the existing compliance, I am completely in support of not paying for existing compliance mitigation. I think we really need to do the public a good service and look at paying for projects that go above and beyond what they're already required to do. My other comment is related to process. I think a few of the public speakers spoke about, you know, the concerns with not having actual text to review, and I just want to say that I share those concerns. It's been very difficult for me to follow, you know, sort of all of these proposed changes without actually seeing them in front of me. I understand that, you know, staff have been, you know, working on this over the weekend in long hours, and we certainly appreciate that and understand the constraints, but we also have an obligation, you know, to make informed decisions and to allow the public a meaningful opportunity to review what's in front of us. And so I am concerned and I guess interested in looking at exploring ways that we could, if there are any, to sort of address this concern. I know in the past we've done creative things to allow the public to see something in draft form, and I'm wondering whether staff has considered alternatives in order to keep this process moving forward and allow us to meet our deadlines.
Well, I think that's actually what we're asking for you today. What we're actually asking you to do is release this. Let us make these modifications, and we're 99% there. I mean, we've talked about 5 or 6 changes that we're going to make. And we're really, it's the one that's really the tough one, and it's this language that continues to be very difficult. We've been working on it for a year and a half on this language. So we all, the commission, I think, is all in agreement of the direction that you want to go on compliance obligations and mitigation. But what's hard is actually writing it down and getting into the language. And so what we're asking for you today to do is to consider letting us make those modifications and let's get it out to the public. And they're going to get a chance to actually comment on it again. But to us, that's kind of the only way to move forward if we want to kind of continue to going to moving on. I mean, we have debated this thing for a year and a half, so nothing's changed. And we're anxious to get the language out there and start. As anxious as you are.
So when... Real quick. So two issues. One is existing. I mean, they're all related, obviously. And then the other is timing and whatnot and what we do now. So just my 2 cents on the existing mitigation or the mitigation responsibilities or compliance obligations is that I'm not... If we're setting a time by which they're going to gauge what they have to put in their application, I'm not sure why existing matters if we're setting a time anyway. I think it's a little confusing. I don't know if I necessarily feel that strongly, but I think what other commissioners have articulated is what I think, which is we're not supposed to be satisfying obligations that someone else is already required to do. I get it. We've got CalSAMS. We've got other obligations that are not flows that you have to put down. And ultimately, I actually kind of looked at it, and I even liked the language that we had before, which was that the footprint, whatever you're required to do because of your project itself, is what I had seen as the exception. So,
actually, I think have that in there as well.
Yeah, and I think that is in there. So, but I've just been confused by some of the discussion about maybe implying that there's more to it than that, and that you can you know, substitute in what I get that it's all going to be very confusing in reality, and it's going to be very difficult to tell what you're doing or not, and it requires adaptive coordination with whatever entities. But that basic understanding has been mine. We're not supposed to do what other people are already required to do. If there's some that are created by virtue of your project itself, and I mean like the footprint of the project, I don't mean the fact that you're going to be providing water to here or there, I mean just your where you are, then that's okay. So I'm not sure if that's consistent with everyone else. I'm not sure that it's even a suggested change. It sounds like that's maybe where staff was going.
Consistent with what we're trying to actually write down.
Okay, because I was just, it sounded a bit from Adam's comments, and maybe I'm mischaracterizing it, and a few others, that maybe it was, you know, broader than what was described.
Well, there's the footprint, and you're right, so that's part of it. But then there's the project benefits that are beyond the footprint.
Of course, which all have to be, right. Okay, that makes sense to me. All right, are there any more on existing environmental mitigation obligations? Any more comments or questions? Then we can go to the timing and Commissioner Quinn.
Sorry, can we just very quickly just summarize? There's a lot of discussion going on here, and I'd really just kind of like to have like bullet points as to what we're going to expect here. Because we're talking about footprints and we're talking about this and that. And so for me, it's a little confusing.
Let me kind of summarize so far what I've heard, and we'll get through the first couple that I think are
got a list
get more difficult after that. So the first one, what I heard is let's add back a resiliency definition, make sure it's very clear. It'll be different than the other definition because last time resiliency was really only focused on climate change.
And tied to public benefits.
We're going to tie it to public benefits. So that's why we've included resiliency, because it's tied to public benefits. Number two, what I think I've heard is we should go beyond just 3 years and let's make it 5 years. Remember that we have over 100 years, or no, not quite 100 years of record that we're using. We're providing that record. There is all of those droughts in there, and so just tell us kind of which one that you want the applicants to focus on, and so we're going to focus on the five-year one. We're going to ask them to focus on the five-year one. And then the third one, and let me stop there, because the third one's the mitigation, and did I miss any other than the mitigation? Is that it? So everything else, I think we're going in the right direction.
Well, everything else that was articulated,
articulated in
the presentation from Joe.
Presentation, and that's what we're going to do. So the third one is the hard one, mitigation and compliance obligations. I believe what I've heard from the commission, not only this time, but for the last several meetings, is the commission is on the same page of how they want to actually define compliance and compliance obligations and mitigation. I think the staff is very clear in the direction that you want us to go and actually what you're expecting out of that. The more difficult part is the actual language itself, and do we get the language to mean exactly what we're trying to say here today? And so that's where we're having a more difficult time. Our approach so far is not necessarily change the definitions that's in the current regulations, because it's the whole issue. It's whether we're paying for existing compliance obligations or not. And I think the problem is you've got the statutes who, again, you've heard folks say it's very clear to them, but they have two differing opinions of what clear means. And so what we're trying to do with the regulation is actually more clarify what that means. And what we're trying to do is implement what we understand the commission is trying to do. So the way we're trying to handle it is, first, we are including on page 25, the idea would be to include the statute regulations back in to make sure that, you know, that is the basis of everything. And then from there on out, what we're trying to do is help the commission with some later, when they get to the applications and start reviewing them, help them understand how they're going to decipher whether it's a existing compliance obligation or not. And the way we're doing that is we're saying, okay, the model's going to be used for the flows. And above and beyond the flows, that's your answer if you're using the model for, you know, certainly the delta and those areas. For non-flows, we're going to require the applicant to put down their compliance obligation and mitigations, and so that there's an understanding of what their thought of baseline was, and then you're going to be able to compare that with their project benefits, and then you're going to have to make the decision of whether you agree with them or not on the non-flow. And then you're going to have to do that again for the folks that are either not using the model, maybe up in a watershed somewhere where we're requiring them to lay out what a compliance obligation and what were their assumptions. And then they're going to lay out their project benefits. And again, you're going to have the tough decision to whether you're going to agree with them or not. And that's, I think, the approach that we're trying to lay it out all on page 25, because that's where we're trying to decipher to give you a little help when you get to that point, how you're actually going to make some of those judgments.
So one piece is it still has the existing definition. So you're restating the statute in the body in 25. But you've got the existing definition we have, which is more expansive and detailed than what's in the act.
Yeah, page 25 would be without the word existing in there. Page 25 would be what the actual statutes write. Our approach was not to try to go back to the definition again, because we're trying to on 25 explain this whole issue of existing and not existing, etc. But we start off with the paragraph with the statutes as is without the word existing in them.
The definition still says existing, though, right?
The definition says existing.
So do we
don't define. We don't redefine. We just basically are now introducing page 25's paragraph with the actual language. And then we co-define, because we now have to separate that out and forget the word existing because it's such a hot topic. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to separate out what are you going to pay for and what are you not going to pay for. Because what we're hearing from the commission is they don't want to pay for compliance obligations that are somebody else's responsibility. That's what existing law is all about in the first place. We're trying to pay for the public benefits that are above and beyond that. But it's going to be your decision.
I hate to say that I don't exactly agree with that.
Okay.
I don't want to pay for existing benefits. However, if a project... However, if a project actually manages to provide public benefits that are existing.
That's correct.
I'm actually okay with that, as long as it's not, we're not being pushed by somebody who should, or we're being used by other agencies that should be paying for that. But if the benefits are such, I mean, I want that flexibility, essentially, is what I'm saying.
And what we're trying to do is actually write into the regulations, you have the flexibility because it's your decision
okay.
to agree or not agree that these are existing compliance obligations or not.
All right.
All we're trying to do is use the model to help us at least on one little piece of it, the flows.
Commissioner Orth? No?
I think we're getting to the cone of certainty here, sort of. Wow.
Yeah, we've talked this one a lot over the years. Okay, so we're where Dave just said we were.
Okay, so where we are is, I think I heard resiliency. Again, we're going to add that definition back. We're going to make sure we tie it to the public benefits. That's the whole purpose of resiliency. We're going to focus everybody on a 5-year drought. Again, all that information is available anyway. And then number three, we're going to deal with this issue of trying to define compliance obligations on page 25, where we first bring back the statute language with no modifications to it, and then we start going through and requiring and making sure folks understand that they have to outline their compliance obligations. It's going to be automatic that it's going to be up to the commission. We don't have to say in these statutes that the commission has to decide because it's obvious, and that's how we would lay out this page 25.
Okay, and then to Commissioner Herrera's comment about
our hope
process and whatnot.
Let us, what we are asking today is give us the direction to do what I just said, along with what Joe's commented on, and let us draft that language and let us release it for public draft, or public comment. And at that point, you're going to be able to make a decision of whether or not, and the public is going to be able to come up here and explain to you whether they agree or not with the language that we came up with. And then we can decide at that point. So, you know, this isn't the last chance that the public gets to see this draft. Our hope is let's release it. Let's let them start looking at it this week.
So to that point then, looking at kind of calendar and process. So if we release it, it would not be officially released for comment until you would technically post it, right, Holly?
Right.
So just to be clear, what Dave is talking about is releasing it pursuant to the APA on the 15-day comment.
Understood.
And it wouldn't be officially open for comment until it's posted. Yeah, that part's true.
Right. So when would we anticipate? I mean, not that obviously.
End of this week, unless we have to work through the weekend, which I'm hoping not, but end of this week. I think we've got it. I think we're there. We're working some fine details with some of the other agencies.
So 18th, let's say 21st at the furthest. So if we release on the 21st, 15 days is?
36th.
The 5th, more or less, of December. So if we have our meeting, which is scheduled for?
The
14th. The 14th, right? With the deadline being the 15th. So, and we, if we were to make changes after the fact, then we have to release for another 15-day public comment period.
Right.
Right. Assuming they're substantive.
Right. So Friday, I'm the wrong person to be doing math in front of everybody, but it sounds like if it's Friday, then meet the deadline or not, in order to meet it, likely would not be able to make changes based upon what you guys provide. Doesn't mean we can't. And obviously, I agree with Commissioner Herrera. We have an obligation to get this right. And I think we've been informed previously that our deadline is really, Holly, what did you say, January for restarting the?
So, yeah, there are two deadlines at play. One's the December 15th statutory deadline. The other one is the one-year Administrative Procedure Act deadline, which I believe runs on January 27th.
Okay, so that's the absolutely have to, or else the whole process starts over.
Right, that's the draconian everything starts over, and we start again with a new notice and a new 45-day public comment period.
Yeah. Okay, any commissioner comments or questions? I mean, that's kind of the lay of the land. Commissioner Quintero?
You know, I'm wondering if, and I'm just going to make a suggestion here, and that is that if we release these on Friday or it ends up being Monday, could we have a commission phone call on Tuesday and still meet? We couldn't.
The provisions of Bagley-Keene require a 10-day notice for a commission meeting. So you cannot.
Okay, no,
yeah.
Commissioner Curtin.
Well, I just want to move the proposal.
Second.
Have a motion and a second. Any discussion? So the proposal then, if I can articulate it, would be to move the language that was submitted plus the changes that have been articulated by Dave here, which were in the presentation and the ones identified, knowing that there's going to be some staff input into what the actual content and language will end up being. Okay. Any other comments, questions? We'll call the roll. Mr. Quintero? Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you had a comment. Okay.
It's a roll call vote. Baker?
Aye.
Commissioner Ball?
Yes.
Chairman Byrne?
Yes.
Commissioner Curtin?
Yes.
Commissioner Del Bosque?
Aye.
Commissioner Herrera?
I'm going to abstain.
Commissioner Orth?
Aye.
And Commissioner Quintero?
I'm going to abstain as well.
We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
So we have 6-2 abstentions.
All right. So that will go out to public comment. And when that does go out, obviously sooner rather than later is better, because it may or may not help us with the overall deadline, but it will give us more options to work within a day or two of the deadline if we need to. So that will conclude that item. So we're coming back, Dave and Tara. The next meeting is scheduled for, and that's the next item on the agenda as well. which is Wednesday, December 14th. We will have concluded the 15-day comment period no matter what, and we'll have an opportunity for receipt and analysis of public comment during that time, and an opportunity to decide how we want to proceed. And I'd suggest after, yeah, I guess that's pretty much what it is. Okay. Anything else for purposes of the item number 12 on the agenda, which is happening at the next meeting? It's going to be all WSIP. Okay. With that, motion to adjourn.
Yes.
Move seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Great. Thank you.